Good evening. My name's Christian Street. I'm the acting mayor of Kingborough. It's my pleasure to welcome you all to tonight's council meeting on Monday, the 15th of June 2026, and a very warm welcome to all of those in the public gallery this evening. Could you please make sure that your mobile phones are now turned onto silent? It's 5:30 p.m. and I now officially declare this meeting open. Council now operates under the Local Government Meeting Procedures Regulations 2025. Under those regulations, I'm required to advise you that an audio or video, an audio or audio-visual recording is being made of the meeting. All persons attending the meeting are to be respectful of and considerate towards other persons attending the meeting, and language and conduct at the meeting that could be perceived as offensive, defamatory or threatening to a person attending the meeting or listening to the recording is not acceptable. The audio recording of council meetings is made publicly available on our website and meetings are live streamed on YouTube. I will now ask staff to confirm that the audio recording has commenced. I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, pay respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge today's Tasmanian Aboriginal community. Attendees this evening, myself, Acting Mayor Councillor Street, Councillor Ann Toley, Councillor Bain, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Dean, Councillor Fox, Councillor Midgley and Councillor Richardson. From our staff, we have our Chief Executive Officer, Mr Dave Stewart, our Director of People and Finance, Mr David Spinks, our Director of Governance, Recreation and Property Services, Mr Daniel Smee, our Director of Engineering Services, Mr Craig Mackey, our Director of Environment, Development and Community Services, Mrs Deleuze Shakuti, our Acting Manager, Development Services, Mr Andy DeCruz, Team Leader, Statutory Planner, Ms Sarah Silva, our Manager, Finance, Mr Anthony Lovell, our Climate Change Advisor, Mr Padre Pierce, our Communications Lead, Ms Sam Adams, and our Acting Executive Assistant, Ms Portia Jones. I have no apologies. Turning to the confirmation of minutes, can I have a mover, please, that the minutes of the open session of Council Meeting Number 10 held on 1 June 2026 be confirmed as a true record. Moved, Councillor Fox, and seconded, Councillor Bain. All those in favour, please say aye. To the contrary, no. That is carried unanimously. Workshops held since the last council meeting. We didn't hold a workshop on the 9th of June 2026. It was deferred to a future date. Moving to declarations of interest, does any councillor have an interest that they would like to declare in any item on tonight's agenda? Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. Thank you, Acting Mayor, in closed session.
I have a conflict of interest for a matter in closed session, the first matter.
Thank you. Any further conflicts for declaration? No. That being the case, we'll move to transfer of agenda items. Is there any item on the agenda that a councillor would like to transfer from open into closed session or closed into open session? No. We'll move to questions without notice from the public. Does any member of the public wish to ask a question without notice?
Good evening. My name is Boyd Inningstamuir. I'm from Kingston. I have three questions this evening, all in light of the recent assaults we've seen here in our community. Question one, can Council confirm whether its CCTV coverage at the Kingston bus interchange is limited to the partial coverage of the B stop area in front of the banks via the cameras mounted on the front of Dave's Noodles, and that there is currently no CCTV coverage of the A stop, which is directly across the road at the corner of Channel Highway and Goshawk Way?
Mr Stewart.
Thanks for the question. We'll need to take that on notice to make sure that our response is accurate.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much. So my second question, can Council confirm that all of its current security cameras are fully functional and still monitored in the Kingston Police Station? And what percentage of time are these cameras being actively monitored, if at all?
Mr Stewart.
I can't comment on what the police do. But they do have access to our CCTV network. I'll just check that it's not working. Cool. Yeah, I can't comment on how the police utilise the CCTV content that they're provided, but they do have access through the access way that the councils provide for CCTV. In terms of the proportion of the cameras that are up and functional, again, I'd need to take that on notice. The way it usually works is the police alert us if any of the cameras go down, and then we can actively understand what the issue is and get the camera back up and running.
Third question. Is Council currently considering a re-establishment of a formal community safety committee or a similar advisory group with an expanded membership, say one that includes Tasmania Police, Kingston Neighbourhood House, West Winds Community Centre, Neighbourhood Watch representatives, locals, schools, etc., and other relevant community organisations to ensure ongoing collaboration and proactive responses to community safety concerns?
The former Community Safety Committee to which you refer did include a presence by Tasmania Police and a number of community members that were engaged on a rolling basis by application. That committee itself actually considered its own disbandment and did disband after considering that community input directly to council and councillors in relation to those matters and really cutting out the middleman in relation to those matters was an appropriate way forward. That was something that the committee considered themselves and took forward themselves, and we agreed on that basis to disband that committee. If there is a proposal at some future date for a committee, I would always be happy to receive that, but I think it's important to note the history of how we got to this point. Good evening.
Good evening. My name is Jennifer Lawrence. I'm from Kingston. It's regarding the Maddox Road dog exercise area. A couple of meetings ago, we were advised that once the planning approval was done on the 1st of June, that a contractor was ready to go on the 2nd, and also that we would not be, or we would be able to use the Kingston Drive area until that one was ready, which was supposedly going to be on the 21st of June. Now, I have not been down there, but several people who exercise their dogs at the dog park have said they've driven past it or gone and had a look at it. There's been some gravel delivered. There's been a few slabs lifted. There's no fencing. There's no work being done in relation to fencing. I'd like to know if the council's monitoring what this contractor is supposed to be doing, and if it's not, what's going to happen on the 21st of June when it's supposed to be ready, and on the 22nd when the Kingston Drive area is supposed to be closed.
All right. Thanks, Ms. Lawrence. A progress update. Yep. Mr. Mackey.
Yeah, thank you for the question. We've started the works there, so we've, as you said, we've got the materials delivered. We've also done some of the tree removal and limb removal that happened earlier this week. The civil contractor will be heading there towards the end of this week to progress those works. I'll have to confirm an update in terms of the fencing contractor, but yes, our objective is to try and marry up those two dates as close as possible. And again, we'll continue to monitor the timing of the timing of the contract commencement up the at Kingston View Drive. And again, we'll continue to see if we can get those two things to marry up as best we can.
Well, if they're only going there at the end of this week, they're going to have to work pretty hard over the weekend.
I'll take that as a comment, Ms. Lawrence.
Yeah. So, I mean, what is the contingency if it's not ready on the 21st?
Mr. Mackey.
There will be a short delay of access to a dog park, but as we've noted before, there are many other dog parks available in the Kingston area. But accept that, and I can provide a...
There is no greyhound area.
Ms. Lawrence.
Sorry, there's no greyhound area other than that one there. So what are people with greyhounds going to do? You have to have a dedicated greyhound yard.
Mr. Stewart?
We acknowledge that it's not ideal to not have access to a dedicated greyhound area. I will note that there are other options for exercising greyhounds, like on leash and in private spaces as well. Look, we don't... it's not a great outcome if there's a period of time, a short period of time, without the greyhound exercise area. I fully acknowledge that.
So basically, when you said that we would have a continuous usage either at Kingston View Drive or at Maddox Road, that's not going to be the case. And yet you said that in the meeting two meetings ago.
Mr. Stewart.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Look, I think we said we would do everything we could to ensure continuity of access. I don't think at any stage we guaranteed that that would be something we could necessarily deliver. I think we are doing everything in our powers to be able to sustain continuity of access, and we will continue to do that.
Alison Rogers, Tinderbox. My first question is in relation to the Snap Send Solve application. I recently used that for the first time. There was a tree over a road after the recent rains. During the process of using that app, it indicated that I should contact the after hours number should it be an emergency or an urgent task, and I figured that given the tree was over the majority of the road that that would be the case. So I did ring and spoke with somebody, and I need to stress that both of my experiences with the after hours and the Snap Send Solve was positive. However, my question is, it became apparent during that process that perhaps the Snap Send Solve app and the after hours number do not talk to each other in the first instance, because the Snap Send Solve app didn't address my issue until the following business day. So whilst the matter was fixed in relation to the after hours number and it was done quickly and well, I'm just wondering from an efficiency point of view why they're not talking to each other, and shouldn't the person rostered on the after hours maybe also get the Snap Send Solve notifications?
Can I just clarify, Ms. Rogers, is the issue that the whatever you've lodged with Snap Send Solve wasn't ticked off as being completed, or...?
Well, there was no real communication after the... Like, the Snap Send Solve application talked to me, but it didn't actually tell me that it was resolved. I knew that it was resolved because, yep, obviously I drove past it. So the after-hours number and council acted promptly and really well, so that was a successful outcome. But I'm thinking, I'm assuming that the Snap Send Solve application costs some funds from the council, and I'm just wondering whether there's a more efficient way for that to work.
Mr. Stewart.
Thanks for the question, and firstly, great to hear that the after-hours process worked well and you were able to get the issue resolved. So I guess coming back to your question, there's probably a couple of parts to the answer. The first is the after-hours service is a third-party contractor that we utilise to be able to take those after-hours calls. So probably rightly they don't have access to any internal council systems as part of that. The second part is around Snap Send Solve. So it's a useful tool, and it's a really good tool that operates across, I guess, infrastructure providers right across Australia and New Zealand as well. And it's a way that people can lodge any issues that they want to see resolved. At this stage, we are not a sort of license holder with Snap Send Solve. So what that means is the platform is a conduit that basically allows you to upload the information, and then it essentially emails it through to us. So it's not an integrated product at this point in time. So we're not paying a license fee for it currently, and it supplies us with the information, but it then doesn't integrate into any council systems. As part of our digital strategy, we intend to put in place a system that allows for a greater degree of integration, whether that be Snap Send Solve or another. So then that will allow a greater degree of transparency and visibility of any issues that are raised, and allow it to more efficiently move through the council system, but also provide an improved customer experience at the back end.
Ms. Rogers.
That's great to hear. My next question is in relation to the LPS hearings. So during a hearing that was conducted by the Tasmanian Planning Commission on Wednesday, the 10th of June, one of the panel members of the Commission indicated, and this, I might add, has not been the first time that they have brought it up in the last recent weeks, that the decision tree that has been created by Irene Inc. in their independent report was, in his words, definitely flawed, creating a bias towards LCZ, or Landscape Conservation Zone. When discussing locations in Kettering and Woodbridge on this day, the panel referred to a road, namely Groombridges Road, that was very similar... referred to a road, namely Whittons Road, that was very similar in characteristics, including topography, vegetation, settlement pattern and protective overlays, to another close-by road, namely Whittons Road. And the Groombridges Road had been recommended in the Irene Inc. report for rural living zone. However, Whittons Road had, I think, a mixture of landscape conservation and rural zone. The panel, the TPC panel that is, questioned the planning authority who was present on the day as to whether the zone applied to the former, the road Whittons Road, was strategically the correct choice and that perhaps rural living zone was a better fit. At this point, the planning authority disagreed. So my question is, given the covering letter that was submitted with the response to Direction 69 that indicated that the council had an appetite for high risk and that where possible the more restrictive zone should apply, why did the planning authority at that point not indicate a different position, even when the Tasmanian Planning Commission was leading to an opportunity for the planning for the planning authority to change its position?
Ms. Shiki.
Thank you. I'll preface this with that we don't want to provide detailed comment about the hearings in a council meeting. It is in and of itself a process at the moment, and due to procedural fairness, it's probably not appropriate to be commenting about that outside of that process. And also, I'm not across that exact scenario that you're describing. So what I think would be a better option is that we will take this on notice and then we can formulate and discuss with the member of staff who was attending what the rationale was at that time. I suppose I would also point out that at the end of the day, it is the Commission's decision-making will be the final decision-maker and they will be considering all evidence before them. And in terms of the risk appetite, we have communicated before and as per the, I suppose, resolution of council, the Irene Inc. report is the starting point and then listening to the evidence and discussions at the hearings, then that risk appetite may be considered when those two zones, two appropriate options are available. So I'm sorry I can't answer tonight, but we'll have to go and review that particular matter on the day.
So I guess my next question is a comment on your response and then further investigation. There's been a number of occasions when perhaps the planning authority has the opportunity to execute the instructions from council, which was to take that high-risk road. I guess my question now would be, is there a particular reason why management or councillors are not necessarily participating in these hearings a great deal? missing quite a lot of vital information that affects that process. Noting that prior to accepting the Irene Inc. report, that Kingborough Land Users Body had actually pointed out some of the flaws and errors in the report and had advocated for that report not to be passed on the night. We understand, due to a time frame process and costs, that we needed to push through, hence the motion from the Acting Mayor and Councillor Antoli on the night, and why perhaps that's not being more highly scrutinised by Council to ensure that that is actually happening.
I think I'm going to take that as a comment, Ms Rogers, unless you can identify for me what the question is.
Well, I'm just wondering why management and councillors perhaps aren't participating in that hearing process to hear what's actually being said.
Look, I would contest that we're not, but I think the point that Ms Chikuti is making is, with the volume of hearing time that's occurring, being able to see all of that for any one councillor or any one member of management staff is very difficult. With respect to specific questions about what's going on in the hearing, we're always happy to take those questions on notice and investigate and come back with responses. And I think you're going to get a much more useful outcome and response if we do that, rather than trying to interrogate the whys and wherefores of what's going on in the hearing during a council meeting like this. But certainly it would be my expectation that any questions about the way that the hearings are going or advice that's given in those hearings would be thoroughly answered.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any further questions from the public?
Hi.
Hello.
Tamika Atkins from Oyster Cove. Given what you just mentioned, my question is also relating to the LPS hearings. So although I do have three questions, and I'm just wondering if I'm...
Let's see how we go.
Okay.
And if we think that we might be able to get a better answer to you if they're taken on notice, then I hope you'll understand that that's probably a good thing.
Yes, no, that's fine. Okay, so when the LPS hearing resumed on the 25th of... the 26th of 5th, Dan Ford opened by asking, if we have a challenge deciding zones, do we refer to the high-risk statement in the cover letter? To which Mr Stander replied, no, we'll be going off the Irene Inc. report. The response appears to directly contradict Section C of the cover letter, which states adopting a high-risk appetite towards landscape values and applying the least restrictive zoning where multiple appropriate options exist has overriding intent. Given the explicit use of the term overriding extent, why has the direction effectively been set aside in favour of the Irene Inc. report? So does it reflect a misunderstanding of the term override or an intentional decision to disregard it?
Mr Stewart?
Yeah, thank you. I'll try and take this question. So the intent of how the motion's worded and the information that we have within the Irene Inc. report lends itself to an application of the decision tree and where there are two potential options at the far end of that that are valid, that Council's risk appetite statement takes effect and we will, be in a position where we'll advocate for the less restrictive of the two options available. So that's the intent of how it works. So it is, in some ways, a secondary process to that of the decision tree, because you have to get to a point where you understand what the meaningful and reasonable options are in the first instance. Secondly, I'll draw your attention to a quote from the lead commissioner for the hearings that he made during the sort of initial hearings when we came back. And it says, the Commission will first hear all evidence on each locality as part of the hearings, and where the panel forms a view that more than one zone could be contemplated for a locality, the panel will issue directions to the planning authority seeking further submissions on appropriate zoning. That was in response to the Council's wording in the resolution around the risk appetite statement. So essentially the way I hear that is, if the panel or the commissioners find that when they're getting to the point of needing to make a call or a decision one way or another, they will, if they believe that there's more than one valid zone, they will provide council with a direction to come back to them. That will allow not just our staff in the room and the consultant there to be able to respond to it, but it will also allow time for management review of those sort of responses to make sure that the risk appetite statement is correctly applied.
Can I clarify that to be clear?
I think before you go, there might just be something further to add from Ms. Shikuti.
Sorry, thank you. Also, the risk appetite statement is in relation to landscape values in terms of potential impacts of the two alternate zones that might be appropriate when that point comes in going through the decision tree and determining what might be appropriate. There could be other reasons that sit outside of landscape values where that would sway, I suppose, either the Commission or the officers attending in terms of what is an appropriate zone. So the risk appetite relates to landscape values and, as you know, under all the different, for example, Section 8 criteria, 8A criteria, there are many different considerations around determining zones. So that could be at times a reason where it's not entirely clear about the risk appetite being applied.
Ms. Atkins.
Yeah, I just for clarification on that, to be clear, so the risk appetite, I understand. So there was several, I guess, representatives that said that could quite easily present the rural living zone being the preferred, I know, but also to the appropriate zone, laying out the settlement patterns and all of the landscape, everything that would need to happen. But on several occasions, Mr. Stander said it would be via the IRENIC report. So there was no opportunity given, I guess, for the TPC to hear the planning authority's high-risk appetite looking at the two zones, because the decision tree, in the words of Dan Ford, were heavily weighted to LCZ. So they missed a question at the start, which meant everything, almost everything, sorry, not everything, almost everything went to that LCZ zone. So I'm still confused, and my question is, why is that not then being represented back to the TPC when the landholders have clearly demonstrated that there is a case for two zones? However, Mr. Stander has been steadfast and referred constantly back to the IRENIC report of LCZ. Does that mean that the TPC don't need to hear from council and they will wait, they will take all this into consideration from the representative themselves?
Mr. Stewart.
Thanks for the question. Look, I haven't directly received that feedback from the Commission that they have any concerns around the structure of that report. In saying that, I'll refer back to the quote that I read out from the Chair of the proceedings, that if the Commission deems that they want to test Council's view as it relates to the risk appetite statement, they will issue a direction to that effect.
Ms. Atkins.
I do have one more. So, again, around the LPS hearing. So at the Woodbridge hearing, again, on the 10th of June, Dan Ford mentioned that, well, he actually told a representative that it was disingenuous to ask for the least restrictive zone generally, as it means different things to different in different places. So if the TPC considers such requests to lack sincerity or a proper understanding of the issue, and Mr. Stander is not advancing on least restrictive zoning options within those hearings, does this indicate that the cover letter was merely a symbolic gesture, or alternatively, were councillors permitted to pass a motion devoid of practical effect, or are their expressed intentions just being disregarded? Because it feels like that it's kind of going around in circles of they said this and they said this, and I understand there's no outcome yet, but it kind of feels like one statement's playing off the other, and I don't know where that lands.
I think, insofar as I can, and with respect, divine what the question is, Ms. Atkins, I might ask Mr. Stewart to respond and he can seek any clarification that he needs to.
Yeah, thank you, Acting Mayor.
You're welcome.
So I can't speak to the detail of the question here. What I would come back to is the fact that we are in the midst of a hearings process. So there is information being presented by representatives, there is information being presented by council and through the external report that was commissioned as well. The commission have powers through the process to be able to ask further questions and to issue directions, which is their tool to be able to get council's formal response to different issues. So I think if the commission had any concerns about the way the information was being presented, then they certainly have a tool available to them to ask council for clarification on the position. At this stage, I haven't heard that there are any requests from the Commission for any clarification there, but we will continue to monitor and support the process.
Thanks, Ms. Atkins. Are there any further questions without notice from the public?
Mark Donnellan from Huntingfield. Are Kingborough's advertised development applications perpetually public information, and can an individual ask for the details of a DA that has passed its advertising period?
Not necessarily is the answer to that question, but is somebody going to help me with more detail than that? There are some significant copyright issues, as I understand, Mr. Donnellan, but perhaps in order to give you an appropriate response, we might take it on notice.
Okay. You feel free to put this on notice too. What is the process involved in completing a request for information regarding a DA, especially with regard to the labour required by council staff?
Can I ask you to clarify what you mean by that?
I might have skipped part of the question. say you want to request information about a DA that has passed its advertising period.
What's the process for doing that?
What's the process for doing that, and what sort of labour is involved on the council side?
We can take that on notice and attempt to provide an answer.
Thank you.
Joel Hodson, Middleton. One of my questions has already been asked twice. I might skip it around what I see as bias in the decision tree for the Iron Inc. report. So I'm going to replace it with a question similar to one that was just asked. Do council cost code their employees' time? As in, do you know what I mean?
Do we know what Mr. Hodson means, Mr. Stewart?
I think so.
Okay, Mr. Stewart.
In certain cases, we do. So, for example, if an employee is working on a capital project, then the employee's time will be capitalised into a particular piece of work. So then, in that case, there's a specific cost code associated with it. More generally, our employees' times are costed to department areas, and we don't break out that work on a billing by the half hour or whatever basis like lawyers might.
Those 6-minute increments here, Mr. Hodson.
Similar. I mean, I've touched lightly on our budget discussions coming up, and only make a comment that I definitely know other councils do a lot of cost coding for all their employees that I've seen personally as a previous employee. I'd leave it as a comment there.
A question, perhaps.
I've got a question, yeah. It was stated at a TPC hearing by the Planning Authority that we need more rural zone in Kingborough. where has this new approach come from, and why is there such an emphasis on rural zone when the value of our agricultural production is so low, the fifth lowest of all LGAs at only 0.45% of total state value, and where the predominant activity at 96% is grazing, which is also a no permit required in rural living zone?
Sorry, I suspect our staff caught this, but just for my own reference, who was the statement made by that we need more rural zoning, Mr. Hodson?
Planning Authority at a recent TPC hearing.
I suspect for the reasons that I've outlined, we're going to want to take that question on notice, but I think we'll take it on notice, Mr. Hodson. Thank you.
It's a question before.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Whether this... In recent hearings, the Planning Authority has repeatedly stated that strategic work identifying LCZ and rural settlements, i.e. for rural living zone or rural zone, has not been done. We discussed this, came up last council meeting. If other councils also had not done this strategic planning, then why has Kingborough's LPS been so different? Or if they had done this strategic planning, why has Kingborough failed to follow suit and conduct this strategic planning prior to the LPS project process?
Mr. Stewart?
Look, it's difficult to comment on what other councils have done there. I guess in the context of our environment, the reason we haven't is we have limited resource and it has been devoted to the LPS process itself. And as I'm sure a lot of people are aware, we are the last council to go through that, which means that, you know, there's been probably a longer tail in this in that timing that has occupied council's resource for a longer period. I will note that other councils are doing strategic work now post the move, the shift to the LPS. Namely, our neighbours, Huon Valley Council, have got a significant grant and undertaking significant structural planning work down there now, which is sort of imagining what the strategic future of Huonville might look like. So it's a really good example of our neighbouring council that has been through the LPS process and now has the runway to be able to look at some of the really meaningful strategic work that they want to do.
Thanks, Mr. Hodson. Further questions?
I'll ask a different one. Kim Phillips, Margate. In relation to, I just want to seek a bit more clarity in relation to Mr. Stewart's answer to Tamika's question. So, where you were talking about the TPC issuing directions, I guess the question for all of us is, we aren't hearing directions being asked for at those hearings. So should we expect that to happen later, or should we actually be pushing during our hearing to say, could we have a direction, please, to send this back to council to look at the high-risk appetite? Because if I talk about myself in my hearing, that didn't come up at all, and obviously I would like my property be looked at.
Mr. Stewart.
Look, it's a difficult question to answer because I'm not going to try and give you advice about how to conduct yourself during hearings. My take on it is the Commission have clearly and publicly articulated what their approach would be, where they consider to be a decision that relates directly to the application of that risk appetite statement. I think that's for the Commission to determine if and when they issue directions.
Can we ask council to seek clarification on behalf of community members as to whether we could expect to... Because I guess the question at the moment is we're seeking clarity, and what we're being told is the high-risk appetite comes in at a later date because at the end of the decision tree it determines whether or not you've got two zones. And at the moment, I think others will agree with me that we're actually a bit confused as to what our expectations should be. So that's the clarity I'm looking for. I'm not looking for an answer, more just trying to understand how is this process working for us, because we are feeling left high and dry by this statement when in the hearings we're not actually seeing that work, essentially. It's looking like it's being ignored. So if we can just ask for clarity, is that appropriate or not appropriate? Is it more appropriate that we go direct to the TPC?
Ms. Shikidi.
I think that's a really good question, and I think it's important that the community and representatives do have as much information as possible to understand the process, particularly as they have, you know, very strong concerns. I don't think it's probably appropriate for the planning authority to go to the TPC on behalf of the representatives, but I would encourage you to contact the TPC and outline this and seek a response back, and perhaps that might then translate into some different methods of communication and clarification during the hearings.
And then the other question I've got is, can we have an update on the Bruny Island SAP review, please?
Sure.
We're not quite as seamless. Yes, of course you can. Unfortunately, it's taking longer than we had hoped or anticipated due to several different reasons, some a little bit outside of our control. At this point in time, we're still working through getting a finalised draft and hoping to have that before council very soon, within one month or at the most two. I think perhaps it's worked out quite well for us in terms of timing, in terms of that there is now a break of the hearings, and that has been fortunate to give us a little bit more time without having an impact to the hearings themselves. So as soon as we have more information and we acknowledge it, it's gone a lot longer than we'd hoped for, and we thank everyone for their patience on that. But as soon as we have another update, we'll provide it. I really hope so, yes.
Thank you. Are there any further questions without notice from the public? No apology necessary.
So throughout the draft local provision schedule process, council's advice to landowners regarding proposed rural and landscape conservation zone zoning was simply that access to a property was required. This is around the Crown Road issue. It was not until after the Irene Inc report was tabled and following a number of requests for clarification that Council formally confirmed via correspondence to Club and subsequently in Council Chambers that Crown Road frontage may present a significant issue for properties proposed to be zoned rural or landscape conservation, particularly where those properties are vacant and reliant on the Crown Road access to obtain a dwelling approval. My first question is, how many properties within the draft LPS schedule are proposed to be zoned rural or landscape conservation that rely on Crown Road frontage for access, and of those properties, how many are currently vacant lots without an existing dwelling?
Ms. Knight, I'm going to suggest that we probably will need to take that on notice, but before we take it on notice, I just want to check with Ms. Shikuti that is the sort of information that we would have available, because I'm just conscious that if it's not, the time associated with working out the answer to that question is likely to be disproportionate to the benefit to respectfully anyone.
Which is part of my other question. Mr. Stander had previously stated in a previous council hearing meeting that those affected property owners were going to receive a letter.
Okay.
So you must be able to get that information.
All right. Ms. Shikuti?
Thank you. I'm not aware of the statement that Mr. Stander made in regards to that. I will say we have answered this question before from a question on notice, but we'll take it on notice again. And
not around the properties that vacant properties that have Crown land.
I believe so, but if we could take it on notice, if we didn't, we'll look to provide a response. But I'm not sure that is information we could easily access or ascertain without detailed property by property assessment of those things. But if we have answered it before, then we'll refer back to that as well.
Well, this will then go to that question. Has Council undertaken any assessment on the properties adversely affected by the Crown Road access issue? If such an assessment has been undertaken, will it be publicly available? And if no assessment has been undertaken, how can Council be satisfied that the proposed zoning recommendations will not result in unintended restrictions on affected landowners, particularly where the issue was only formally acknowledged after representations had already been lodged and hearings were underway?
I think, given the answer to the first question, we'd probably better take that question on notice, Ms. Knight. Thank you.
Third question relates to Mr. Stander. So at a recent council meeting, I think it was two council meetings ago, Mr. Stander advised that affected landowners would be contacted regarding the Crown Road access issue and stated that property owners would be sent a letter. However, subsequent correspondence from Mrs. Shakuti in response to the question without notice from Mr. Hodson indicated that information would instead be provided through a council newsletter. So my question is, when did Council first become aware that Crown Road frontage may prevent or significantly impede development within the Rural and Landscape Conservation Zone? And if Council was aware of this issue and knew which properties may be affected, why were those landowners not individually notified before the hearing process commenced, or at the very least before the hearings concluded, so that they could make fully informed representation to the Tasmanian Planning Commission? And further to that, given that this issue may directly affect property rights, development potential and land value for individual landowners, how does Council consider publication in a general newsletter to satisfy the principles of transparency, procedural fairness and natural justice, particularly when affected landowners could have been identified and contacted directly?
We're going to take it on notice, Ms. Knight, and I will note that it was about five questions in one go.
Yes, I got it in there, though.
But we'll take it on notice. Are there any further questions without notice from the public? No. That being the case, we'll move to questions on notice from the public. We took one question on notice from the public at the last meeting on debt from Will Perry, and a response from David Sphinx is contained in the agenda papers. Moving on to questions without notice from councillors. Does any councillor wish to ask a question without notice? Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. Just one question from me tonight, and it's a matter that was raised with yourself and community member Joe Westwood and myself regarding some traffic and safety around St. Aloysius School. When traffic is entering that sort of precinct area from the new subdivision in Huntingfield, there is no signage around, say, the 40-kilometre zone, which is consistent on that road across from the school there. And so there is a request after the community member Joe Westwood met with the school on Friday in regards to an urgent action to be required, and that is if we can look at the placing a 40-kilometre sign there as soon as possible, or if not, we have those trailers that were obtained through a community road safety grant that you can actually put a temporary kind of trailer up there displaying the 40-kilometre sign. Just wondering at all if that could be actioned before we look at a permanent sign.
I need to promise my colleagues and members of the public that this is not a Dorothy Dixer and you haven't set me up, but it was an issue that was raised with me last week also. Pleasingly, we do have some progress. The Transport Commission has approved the extension of the 40-kilometre-an-hour zone to include the new approach to the intersection that you've referenced. The Department of State Growth are going to arrange for installation of new electronic school zone signs in the area. That's been approved. In the interim, they've asked us to erect temporary signage as soon as possible, which we're going to do. And so those signs have been ordered and we'll arrange their installation as soon as they've been received. We're looking at other things, including improving sight lines and trimming of trees, and those works are to be conducted in the coming weeks. I understand that we've also undertaken several site inspections during the morning and afternoon school peak periods, and we're looking at the way in which students are actually directed across the road to try and make that safer as well. And then in addition to all of that, we're going to do the work required to look at whether it's appropriate to get, and Mr Mackey will correct me if I get the wording wrong, there's a warrant for a school crossing guard at that site as well in the near future. So that's what's going on. If Mr Mackey has anything further to add in relation to that, then he can, but otherwise that's the situation. And it's been communicated to the school today that that's what's happening. Are there any further questions without notice from councillors? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I have some questions on behalf of some residents that live in Firthside. They have a back fences that overlook the southern outlet, which, as we know, are blighted with graffiti. The questions are really advice on jurisdiction for them, if possible. These residents are upset that their back fence is constantly covered in graffiti, which we've all seen when we enter Kingston and you look to the left and to the right, you see that line of fence. Some of the residents are planning on selling those properties to downsize. They're retired. They're frustrated that they've been told it's not council's responsibility, it's not Department of State Growth's. They've gone to the police have told them to try council, they've gone around and around. So are they, they've asked two questions on the areas of advice. There's allegedly a magic paint, they've been told, that if they apply it to that fence, it makes the clean-up process so much more easier. Are they allowed to apply said paint? That's the first question. Should I line up the questions first or just give them one at a time?
Well, look, I'm seeing whether anybody knows the answer first, Councillor Antoli, and we'll go from there. Okay. Mr Smee.
There is indeed a paint, for want of a better word, that you can apply that assists in the removal of graffiti. However, I would say that the fence in question, if it's a paling fence, that won't have a lot of benefit in terms of graffiti removal.
It's a colour bond fence.
Okay, then it may have some.
So so they would have permission to paint it, would they? As long as it's, is, do they have to keep it in the same colour as existing, or how, what's the planning jurisdiction on that?
It wouldn't be our permission to give Councillor Antoli, but Mr Smee might know whose permission it is, if any.
Technically, if it's their boundary fence, they own the fence, they share it. I would imagine in this case it's with the Department of State Growth. It depends on who owns the adjoining land, but my guess would be it's Department of State Growth. Technically it's their fence and they could apply that. And in relation to the colour, that would be a planning scheme issue that I'm not able to answer.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. State Growth told them it has nothing to do with us. Don't even ask us. They've approached State Growth.
Sounds like it has nothing to do with anyone, Councillor Antoli, which means self-help may well be a decent remedy.
Yes, I'm advising the same, but in a way that is trauma-informed, because they feel traumatised by the whole process. If I had liaised with you separately, can you advise me what this magical paint is so I can pass it on to them? Is that possible? Thank you. The second question is around screening. Are they permitted to put some sort of screening along close to that fence that deters people from reoffending? What is the jurisdiction on that?
I suspect we might be getting murkier, but Mr Smee?
That comes down to whoever owns the land. I mean, the fence is clearly joint ownership between the two adjoining neighbours, but if the adjoining land is clearly not owned by the residents, and they would need to seek permission from the landowner to plant trees within it.
So if it's their back...
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. If it's their back fence, that would be their ownership, wouldn't it? Only if it's a shared fence, it's joint.
It depends which side of the fence we're talking. If it's within their backyard, yes, they own the land,
yes,
and they can plant trees. But if it's the other side of the fence, which I suspect that's what it is,
yes,
then it depends who owns that land. And my guess is that it is the state government own that land.
Yeah, my guess is that it is
as well. And they would need permission to plant trees within it.
Okay. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. That's all the vexing questions from me.
Are there any further questions without notice? Councillor Dane.
Thanks, Acting Mayor. First question is soccer related. There's obviously been a couple of big soccer games of late, and probably unlike the CEO, who still thinks the All Whites are a chance, Australia's going to win the World Cup, and I look forward to that happening. But there was a bigger game other than yesterday's victory over Turkey, and that was the King of the Lions winning the statewide cup and the Sunday previous. So I was just wondering whether we as a council might like to offer some kind of support to the club in recognition of their efforts. I note that in Chambers we have a few examples of sporting memorabilia, and whether we might be able to reach out from the club and congratulate them, but also offer them the opportunity to recognise their efforts, noting that it was the first senior bit of silverware for the club in their history. It's the biggest tournament to win in the state, so just wondering if you'd like to chase that up.
Huge opportunity for the Canberra Lions. I was up there on the weekend. I've seen the trophy. It is enormous. But obviously what goes along with that is that they're into the round of 32 for the Australia Cup. And I'm told that on the 22nd of June we'll find out whether we will have a game to be played at Lightwood Park, which could potentially be one of the 10 A-League teams, which would be an incredible opportunity for Canberra and for the Lions. I'm happy to write to the Lions and congratulate them on that massive achievement. But as I said, I was up there over the weekend sharing in their reflected glory.
A few more, or not more important, but more serious questions, perhaps. Just in relation to the Southern Obedience Club, could there be an update? Obviously, last council agenda, or last council meeting, we deferred a report to consult on finding a new location. So could we just have an update on where that sits currently?
Mr. Smee.
Thank you. We've been able to negotiate with the contractors undertaking work within the precinct an arrangement that will enable the Southern Obedience Club to remain at their current location through until the 31st of October. That's really important because it enables us to buy some time to further investigate options with respect to their new location, and that's what staff are currently doing, and we intend to bring a report back to council with an assessment of the various options within the next month.
Councillor Dean.
Terrific. Great to hear. I also had a number of questions in relation to the Salty Dog, the noise situation there, but on reflection, given we don't have our expert EHO available to us, I might email those through and get them on notice rather than ask six into the record.
That will obtain the same outcome, Councillor Dean. Terrific. So I'd appreciate it.
I do notice.
You can.
Thank you very much, Mayor.
Are there any further questions without notice from councillors? No. That being the case, we move to questions on notice from councillors, and at the time the agenda was compiled, there were no questions on notice from councillors. The open session of council therefore adjourns, and the planning authority commences at 6:28 p.m. Moving to page 5. Item 12.1, DA 2025-263, development application for manager's residence at 1 Lumia Road, Adventure Bay. Can I have a mover and seconder, please, for the recommended motion on page 26? Moved by Councillor Bain, seconded by Councillor Midgley. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. So this application seeks approval to demolish an existing timber outbuilding and construct a manager's residence associated with the existing visitor accommodation, along with reconfigured parking layouts and extension to the on-site wastewater treatment system. For this application, there are four objections and the recommendation is for approval. The site's zoned low-density residential and has had a few development and building applications starting back to 2000. Started with three visitor accommodation units in 2012 and added another two in 2015 to arrive at the five there today. Privacy of adjoining properties is raised in the report and has been addressed via several of the windows having higher heights and the deck having a privacy screen. The report tells us that the scale of the development is consistent with the surrounding area, and having on-site supervision will help ensure the guests in the five existing visitor accommodation units don't impact surrounding residents. I noticed that one of the things raised in the representation was concerned around building heights, setbacks and visual impact. And in the report from the council officer, it talks about this part of the assessment coming down to whether the result and loss of amenity is considered unreasonable. So just through you, Chair, can we have a bit of a summary from council officers around some of the aspects that led to these areas being considered reasonable in the report?
Yes, sir.
There are a couple of different clauses that were triggered for this and required an assessment against the performance criteria. One of them was the visitor accommodation clause. The manager's unit, which is subservient to the visitor accommodation use, so therefore it is in the same use class and needs to be assessed against that visitor accommodation clause. It didn't meet the acceptable solution for that. So the performance criteria considers things like amenity impacts and visual impacts, the compatibility of the new unit with the adjoining properties and the streetscape, and then also the non-dwelling development standards, which it didn't comply with because it is slightly outside of the building envelope to the rear, so it needs a 4 metre setback in the low-density residential zone, and it proposes a 1 metre setback. All other setbacks it complies with. So that required us to look at a few similar things, but a few different things. One of them's, it's all in the report, so I'll just scroll down. So about overshadowing and loss of light. A lot of the properties there are set back quite far from the shared boundary. The closest setback is about 30 metres. Where that actual manager's unit will be, it's quite flat, and then it slopes down to the southeast of the site, which is why it's on stilts to minimise earthworks. So that's why it's a bit higher. So it's got a total height of about 6.5 metres. In that zone, you can have 8.5 metres, so it is a fair bit lower than what the acceptable solution is. We look at things like, we've put quite a big blurb in there for visual impact and amenity. Things like visual sensitivity, which would be the, that would relate to the neighbouring properties because they're there all the time, and what they, we looked at their outlook. Most of them either have no windows or windows that overlook the coast, which is hopefully where your window would be to overlook the views there. So the visitor accommodation would be in their peripheral vision rather than their main vision. There's one vacant lot to the south, which is in an inundation area, so any dwelling in the future would need to be raised up anyway for that one. And then the other one, which is, sorry, I can't remember if it's 6 or 8, but the one of them has a small kitchen window that overlooks the manager's unit, but then the other window overlooks the water there as well. So for that reason, we didn't think the visual impacts would be that much to those properties, in addition to the large buffers and the fact that there's quite a lot of large trees around the site that aren't supposed to be removed, and it's quite flat apart from the southeast where it slopes down, so it's quite flat so that it wouldn't be that visible from the you'd be able to see it for sure. With the impact to us was not unreasonable for those reasons. And just the general character, the site coverage meets the acceptable solution, and it's generally in similar to other developments in the area, which is a mix of residential and visitor accommodation units as well. So for those reasons, on balance, we considered that there would not be an unreasonable loss of amenity in this instance. There are also a couple of, quite a few design considerations for that building in particular. They have quite a flat roof, muted colours, articulated building design to help minimise visual impacts when viewed from an adjoining property. And then there's also the other issue that's raised often with visitor accommodation, and that's complaints and all that. So with the visitor, with the manager's residence on site, hopefully that will enable a quick response if there are any complaints from neighbouring residents in the future. So all those things are considered under the performance criteria, and the conclusion was that it could meet the performance criteria for each of the clauses that were needed to be considered.
Councillor Bain.
Thank you. It's a great response. And, based on all the information in the report and that response, I'm happy to support the recommendation to approve.
Thank you. Are there any further speakers? Councillor Antolli.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I just have a quick question. So, first of all, I thought that the objections are really well answered, and I thought it was a very clear report, and it's good to see some great accountability from the owners there to put a manager on site. I have a question regarding the whether the site is prone to bushfire at all.
Ms. Silver.
It probably is. 98% of Tasmania is, so I'd be surprised if it isn't. But I'll just look it up.
While you're doing that, if I may.
Councillor Antolli.
Thank you. While you're doing that, if I may, I'm just wondering if I might have missed it, and it's entirely possible, but I didn't really notice whether the bushfire prone area code was triggered.
Okay, apologies for the delay. It's not in the assessment checklist. I'm just going to check on our mapping. It's literally just to the south of the site, so it's in the 2% in Tasmania that's outside of the overlay.
Buy a lottery ticket.
Yeah, that's
the lucky ones. That was my only question, was around whether or not, and obviously it's not, needs to be, so thank you, and I'll be supporting it likewise.
Are there any further speakers for the motion? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. A lot of the stuff has been covered, but I am interested to talk more about the blue gum tree, the mature very high conservation value tree. I'm looking specifically at the planner's response to the issue raised by representatives regarding concerns about potential impacts on the viability of that neighbouring tree in relation to root damage, and I do note that there's conditions on the permit making sure that excavation activities and fencing and the like are in place to protect specific tree protection measures. The bit that kind of confused me a little bit is it says, and this is a quote on page 25 in the planner's response, while the concerns raised in the representation are acknowledged, no contrary technical evidence has been provided. In this context, the planning authority relies on the findings of the submitted arborist report, which classifies the encroachment as minor and concludes that standard tree protection measures are sufficient to maintain the tree's viability. The bit that I'd like to zoom in on is this idea that no contrary technical evidence has been provided. Is it the expectation somehow that a representor is supposed to, or I guess the neighbouring tree owner was supposed to, in order to provide contrary technical evidence, is there some kind of onus then on the owner of that tree to provide their own technical report, an arborist report, to provide contrary evidence in that case?
I suspect that the answer to the question is sloppy drafting in relation to that part of the, or slightly sloppy drafting in relation to that part of the report, but Ms. Silver may have a different response.
I agree. What we need is a suitably qualified person, being the arborist, to confirm that the impacts to the tree will be acceptable, and that's what the applicant has provided, and that's enough to satisfy the performance criteria. Yeah, but I think the wording maybe could have been a little bit better in the report.
Thank you.
I just wanted to briefly address the notion of overdevelopment in this particular site-specific context. And my understanding, and I'm seeking clarity here, is that this is not legally considered to be overdevelopment because it's less than 25% of the land. But I just wanted to know, to what extent is there subjectivity available to a planning authority with that regard? You know, sometimes the bulk... I mean, in this particular case, you know, I'm convinced that the size and bulk of the manager's residence is not unreasonable. But I just wanted, I guess, a bit more clarity about, is it that it's a hard and fast rule that up to 25% of the site, anything over that counts as overdevelopment in a legal sense and anything under that doesn't? Or is there subjectivity around the lie of the land and the visual amenity to neighbours and things like that?
Yes, sir.
There's subjectivity with that. It all is case by case and it depends on various factors. So we look at all the parts of the performance criteria that are in the planning scheme, and that relates to like site coverage, character, visual impact, setbacks, and it could be even like in a rural zone, colours and all those factors we look at when we're assessing whether something's overdeveloped or not. It might be like the road infrastructure, it might be the sewerage and, you know, the size of the site and the sewerage and water and the on-site wastewater. There's lots of different things that we would look at. Yeah.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. And through you, Acting Mayor, I'll just conclude my remarks by saying that I think ultimately, as it says, it's on page 23, that the proposed building is modest in scale, comprising a single-storey structure with a floor area of 70.4 metres squared and a low-pitched roof. Its design incorporates measures to reduce visual impact, including articulation of the building form, muted colours and sitting as close as practicable to existing infrastructure. On that basis, and I don't think it is in contravention of the planning scheme, I think it's subjective though it may be, I think it is appropriate development, and I will support the motion. Thank you.
Are there any further speakers on the motion? Councillor Bain, summing up? That being the case, I'll put the recommended motion as moved by Councillor Bain and seconded by Councillor Midgley, which is contained on page 26 of the agenda. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no. That motion is carried unanimously. With that, the Planning Authority adjourns and the open session recommences at 6:42 p.m. On to page 61, petitions still being actioned. There are no petitions still being actioned. Petitions received in the last period. At the time the agenda was compiled, no petitions had been received. Moving on to officers' reports to council. Can I have a mover, please, that the appendices in item 15.1 be received and noted? Councillor Antoli moves and Councillor Fox seconds. Councillor Antoli, any commentary from any councillor in relation to the appendices? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I just wanted to briefly speak in congratulations to the team regarding the Environmental Services Quarter 3 report. There is a wealth of information in there that emphasises the important work, not just around environmental management and care for our biodiversity, which of course is critical, but also I think the more prosaic and perhaps undersung heroic activities of those who are making sure that our, you know, food provision is safe, doing water quality testing. There's so many different elements that our Natural Areas Biodiversity team and the broader Environmental Services team undertake. Weed management, the revegetation program, the tree assessments, groundwater monitoring, as I mentioned, and coastal hazards, which are becoming more and more of a critical issue as we move further into a phase where we get more frequent and severe weather events. I just thought, particularly around something that is very sensitive to the community, bushfire management, there is really a good fuel break widening going on, things like the work at Taruna. So I just wanted to, I guess, pay homage to the team for their great work and this very comprehensive report, which I think is worthy of high praise. So thank you.
Are there any further speakers on the motion? I assume Councillor Antoli doesn't want to sum up. That being the case, move the motion as put by Councillor Antoli and seconded by Councillor Fox. All those of that opinion say aye. To the contrary, no. That's carried unanimously. Moving on to item 15.2, AGM Notice of Motion Response Supporting Residents to Improve Energy Efficiency, and the recommended motion on page 63. Do I have a mover for the recommended motion? Councillor Cordova, and a seconder in Councillor Fox.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. So at the AGM at the end of, in December of 2025, a motion was passed that during 2026, Kingborough Council investigates and reports back on affordable and cost-effective options to assist Kingborough residents to improve the energy efficiency, costs of running and comfort of their homes. I went along to the re-energise forum that was held at the Kingborough Community Hub, and it was nothing short of amazing in terms of the breadth of education and opportunities available there, particularly around, I think there was this, I had a misconception that it was quite expensive to make housing more energy efficient, but what was really, I guess, enlightening was how, pardon the pun there, enlightening, what was really important was that there's a whole range of interventions that can take place, some of which are very affordable, and the council does indeed play a role in providing education and encouraging people to adopt anything that they can do, because it's a win-win-win, really. It's you get to reduce your household expenses, which are really important in a time of cost of living crisis. You get to have a more efficient energy system and improve your own resilience in the case of when power grids go down and the like, in storms and situations like that. And you also get to have environmental benefits as a result of being more energy efficient. So I just thought what the council is doing in this particular case is that there is a community electrification program that's being launched by Aurora Energy through a third-party provider, and the suggestion here is that council's proposing to contribute $7,000, with other councils contributing between $6,000 and $8,000, which will allow for the establishment of the program and for 1 year of delivery. And members of the RICI, the Regional Climate Change Initiative, are establishing a framework to engage with organisations, with an organisation who's a social enterprise, and delivers existing electrification programs for other Australian councils, which include no-cost and low-cost options for homeowners and renters, as well as the higher initial cost improvements such as rooftop solar. So I think this is a sensible response to what is a really good initiative from our community, and I note that it was passed with really comprehensive support at the AGM, and certainly the attendance at that Energise Forum at the Kingborough Community Hub, I think is testament to the fact that there's significant community interest in this issue as well. So I did want to pay a special thanks to Net Zero Channel and all of the advocates within our community who are campaigning for better energy efficiency and reducing household costs, and also to our team, Padraig Pierce and Liz Quinn, the author and authoriser of this report, and the entire team for the work they've done. I commend the motion. Thank you.
Councillor Dean.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. Maybe I've misread this report, because my questions were going to be about what our contribution is, kind of more specifics as to where our contribution is going towards, because the report states we don't want to compete with the existing Aurora program that's being launched, but we want to target kind of renters, because I gather Aurora's only obviously dealing with those that are paying the bills and have their own home. So can I just get some clarity on, are we giving money to Aurora to run their thing, or are you doing something to complement it?
Mr. Pearce.
Thank you for the question. So the Aurora program is run through a company called Boom Power, which is separate to the program being discussed in the report. So Boom Power, logically being run by Aurora, is about energy efficiency for appliances in particular, so people who are paying for those bills, and includes things such as increasing solar, the electricity used for your hot water and for heating the house, but that is the limit of their system. The system that we are proposing, in addition to that, also targets those no-cost and low-cost solutions that are outside electricity usage directly. So it may be about thermal comfort of your home, reducing drafts, installing curtains using the low power settings on your appliances, as well as those other services. So it's designed to complement rather than directly compete with, but no, it's not with Aurora.
Councillor Dean.
Thank you. That's partially answered my question. I'm just, how are we going to do that?
So there's there is a separate provider that we are looking to partner with, which is the social enterprise. So there is Boom Power, which is the provider that Aurora is using, and there is a separate one that we are exploring who have delivered the Electrify 2515 program in New South Wales. So it would be a different provider, so a third-party provider.
Councillor Dean.
I think we're getting closer. So the provider that did this in New South Wales, I'm just not familiar with that program. So what did they do to help, you know, low budget households or renters do all the things you've just mentioned? Can you give me the specifics? Are you aware of the program?
Mr. Pearce,
thanks.
Thank you. Without going into the details of the name of the provider, because we would have to go through a process to ensure that they are who we go to with the contract, they provide a service through marketing awareness of their services, so encouraging awareness of community electrification, and then the user can then go through, they do a consistent quiz about where their usage is at, how much power they use, what solutions they already use, and it provides three tiers of response to say these are the no-cost options that you could do within your household, such as using these low-cost settings on your appliances or improving insulation. These are the low-cost options, which may about looking at tariffs or about looking at the smaller cost appliances, and then these are the higher-cost services. It then links out to service providers who do those installations, such as solar, hot water cylinders and similar, ensuring that they're pre-vetted, and provides a concierge service. So after they've gone through the quiz, the service provider can reach out and say, do you have further questions about this service? Is there anything else you would like to know? What is beneficial about the service we are looking at is it provides a whole of life cycle follow-up for them. So rather than have they used this service, no, that's where the conversation ends. If in 2 years they have selected one of those services, they can notify and say, you didn't provide us one of the options that I selected, but ultimately I did choose to install solar panels. And then it's still considered in the data about community awareness was raised about that item, and we were supporting the community in making those decisions.
Mr. Pearce, do I take it that really these discussions in relation to this program are in their infancy, or is it a program that's ready to go now that's being proposed for our involvement?
So it is a program that we are still negotiating with other partner councils through Wiki, so I don't have the specifics to hand. We would need to still finalise what the arrangement is.
Okay. Councillor Dean.
I guess you're, Acting Mayor, kind of getting towards my next question. We're signing off on initial approval to co-contribute to this.
Well, I'm just going to stop you there, Councillor Dean. I think if you actually read the recommended motion, we're noting our intention to provide a community energy efficiency program and that this supports the AGM motion. I think we're noting our intention to provide it. I don't think we're being asked to formally approve the contribution this evening. Councillor Dean.
Yeah, I take your point. It's budgeted for, so I was just trying to get to more specifics of what we're supporting it. It's been budgeted for. I just kind of wanted to get at the specifics of it to ease my mind. Sounds like a great idea and a great initiative. I just wanted a bit more clarity. I've got some of it. Enough of it, I think. Thank
you. Are there any other speakers on the motion? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I do share Councillor Dean's concerns. I think it is unclear. It sounds like we are asking to support this because there is money attached. There's no information about Boom. There's no information about the social enterprise provider that delivers this program. From a governance point of view, when I have questions that can't be answered, it normally results in a no. So from my point of view, this report actually creates more questions than gives me answers. I live in a household, Acting Mayor, that is got tons of solar panels. I have a big battery. I try and I've done that purely for cost reduction in my own life rather than any net zero need. I like the fact that the program delivers some low-cost options and solutions to renters who have minimal control over their asset that they live in, or it's not their asset, their landlord's asset, and they want to reduce the cost. I like that part. But I'd like to know, where is this money going, and for what is the purpose, what is the outcome? Yes, it's a co-contribution in the range of $6,000 to $8,000 from a range of councils. To whom and when, and I'd like some answers on that if possible.
Mr. Stewart.
Thanks for the points you've raised, Councillor Antoli. I guess within Council's budgets, we enter a financial year with
some areas where there's investment put in to deliver an outcome before the details of exactly what the scope of the work is or any procurement activity has been undertaken. We do that because we need a budget to have before we go into the program of work for that year. The reason this is coming towards you tonight is because there was a motion passed at the AGM and we're responding to that. It was asking for an indication of what council is going to be doing within the space, and the team have provided an update to the best of our knowledge and information at this stage. It shows a direction of travel, it shows the work that's being done in the background between different councils around an initiative that will likely have benefit to our community in terms of improving the efficiency within their homes. In saying that, there's more work to be done on it. There's more work to do to understand whether or not this is the best investment that we have for this particular line item in Council's budget, and we will do that as part of normal operating procedure.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. That was a helpful answer. I appreciate that. So if I can ask a follow-up question, before we enter into any arrangement, given this is a small figure, will this be just actioned by General Manager or will it come back to Council for a decision?
Mr. Stewart.
So this sort of level of investment would be expended under delegation.
Councillor Antoli.
I think I'll hold my questions for now because I'd like to hear what other people have to say. Thanks.
Are there any other speakers on the motion? Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. Thanks to the Council officers for the report, and it's great that we have this group, electrifying kind of group across councils looking at these matters. There's a lot of groups across all of these council areas that actually do a lot of volunteer work in this space. And Net Zero is one example of that. They're a community group based down in our rural area, out in the Kettering, Woodbridge sort of areas. They're a group of passionate people who want to make a difference in this space, and they're the people who put this AGM motion forward. They've received many grants to kind of do some work themselves in these areas, looking at households and this is, I guess this motion was great that they put it forward and seeing what council can do, and now we've got a bit of an option. So we've got a bit of a, you know, maybe it might come back for a bit of a discussion. We might hear a bit more about the project, but I support that it's under the council delegation. It fits within our strategic priorities around our climate change policy and action plans and net zero in that area. So I think it's you know, fortuitous that we have this availability before us, that there is other councils working towards this, and I think it's important to support.
Councillor Cordova with a question.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. The question is around the home energy audit toolkits, the heat kits, and this might put a bit of meat on the bones of what these programs sometimes look like, not always, but sometimes. Is it true that our council still has some heat kits available for members of the community to borrow? And it might be a useful opportunity to kind of explain what these smart devices are, where you get to kind of look at your energy usage. And so is it true that we still have heat kits available for community members to borrow?
Mr. Pearce.
Yes, it is true that we have a number of home energy audit toolkits available, or HEATs. They're available for community usage through the customer service area. So they provide tools for community members to be able to assess the thermal efficiency and energy efficiency of their homes and understand what opportunities they have to improve their operation.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. Thanks for that answer. Mr. Pearce, is there any relationship between the proposal here tonight and, for example, getting more heat kits or providing heat kits through this $7,000? Do heat kits have anything to do with what we're talking about tonight?
Mr. Pearce.
Not with this motion. So this motion relates to essentially the licensing arrangement required to enter into partnership with the service provided. So each partner council is allocating how many households they would like to be able to go through it, and each of those attaches a value. So rather than going for example, 40,000 homes through the licence, the group of councils is looking at it, how many people we think are likely to go through it for each area, and we are putting forward funds to cost our level of that.
Are there any other speakers on the motion? Councillor Antoli.
I have more questions, if I may, Acting Mayor. The social enterprise that's delivering it, is that Boom that was mentioned or a different organisation?
I believe it was stated to be a different organisation, yep. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. And what measurable results has it produced from other councils that have used it? Can I have an answer on that?
Mr Pearce, is that a question that we can answer at this stage?
Anecdotally, apologies because I don't have the data in front of me. I know there has been strong uptake in New South Wales. However, this would be a new usage in Tasmania, which is why we are looking at it as a regional collaboration.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. So as I understand it, it's an education and coordination service. A concierge was mentioned. Is that fair?
Mr Pearce?
Partially. So it is partially an education concierge service and a pre-vetting of installers. So if someone goes through and says they would like to install, for example, solar panels, it then connects them to a number of pre-approved installers. One of the benefits of the service we are exploring is households are able to identify their own providers and bring it to the service to say, does this align financially? So it is linking with installers as well as the education component.
Councillor Antoli.
And does the service provider who does the concierge get any kickbacks from these installers?
Mr Pearce.
No, which is the requirement for the funding for this particular service.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. It's like a tennis game. So the funding, the $7,000, is to, I suppose, fund the service because we're not all made of money. It has to come from somewhere. Is that how it sort of works? It's sort of a joint. We sort of pool our resources as councils to make it worthwhile for that greater LGA community?
Mr Pearce.
Correct. Okay.
Councillor Antoli.
Okay. Thank you. I would like to add that it would have been good if we'd had more information in this report. I understand it's our response to an AGM, an albeit a totally reasonable AGM question that was voted for, I think it was unanimous from my memory.
It was either unanimous or very strong support.
Yeah, exactly. And I want to respect that. I want to respect the process and in no way denigrate what it was intending to do, but also respect ratepayer funds. Pennies add up to pounds. We are in a situation where we are in debt and that we are running a budget deficit, which we will all discuss later tonight. So I'm just trying to understand the governance around it all, and it would have been good if we could have a little bit of information in the report around Boom, some of the stats that they could bring, the relationship to Aurora. So based on that, I will probably vote in favour, because what I do like about it is that one of the target... and I've done my own research, is that key target audience is not just those with established homes, but it's renters who are more exposed to electricity costs as a burden to them.
Are there any further speakers on the motion? There being no further speakers on the motion, Councillor Cordova, would you like to sum up?
Briefly. Thank you, Acting Mayor. I think it's been a good discussion, and once again, I think... the $7,000 will be a drop in the bucket, but what the community has clearly said is they're really interested in finding solutions to ameliorate the cost of living crisis, and one way to do that is through energy efficiency in the home. And I guess circling back to my initial commentary around the fact that I was under the misapprehension that, you know, we have to get expensive solar panels or buy an electric car, which is cost prohibitive, but in fact there's very many things that we can do, even from as simple as air leakage detection. Seeing where the drafts are coming into your house, and you can do that with, you know, these smart kits or just with education, that can make an enormous difference to your energy efficiency, and it's basically free in order to implement that. And in terms of the comfort that you get in your home, the cost effectiveness, and also the environmental benefits as well, it's a really good initiative, and it's one area where I think by the council leaning into this, we're going to have another really tangible positive impact on people's everyday experience in Kingborough, and I think it's a really good thing. So once again, I commend the people working on this. Thank you.
The motion is as moved by Councillor Cordova and seconded by Councillor Fox. It's contained on page 68 of the 63 of the agenda, rather. All those in favour, please say aye. To the contrary, no. The motion is carried unanimously. Before I move on to the rates and charges policy update, I'm just conscious that we probably do need a break at some stage. Would a break now be appropriate? If I were to say 5 minutes, is that long enough? Well, why don't I give you six and we say we come back at 7:10?
Thank you.
How generous of a
4 with the rates and charges policy update. Do I have a mover, please, for the recommended motion on page 66? Councillor Cordova moves. Seconded, Councillor Bain. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. This proposal is that the rates and charges policy requires updating to account for the variation in rates pertaining to commercial and industrial use. And given the demonstrated capacity for the council to vary rates for short stay visitor accommodation as a commercial residential use category, and this is ever since 2019 when the state government allowed such a thing, council should also incorporate this into its policy update, and these updates to the policy will keep council's rates and charges practices in line with the principles of fairness and equity in rates as a form of taxation revenue from all ratepayers to fund the outcomes of council under the strategic plan and long-term financial plan. Without bearing the lead, the concept here is to increase by 50% the rates on dwellings that are being used for short-stay visitor accommodation. And the reasoning here is that because these properties are being used for commercial reasons, they should pay somewhat nearer to a commercial rate than they currently are. And there's a principle of equity and fairness involved in that. I want to say at the outset that fundamentally, if this policy takes effect, because there is still a disparity between those people who are using their dwellings for short stay accommodation and, I guess, in a way, doing the right thing and therefore have been registered, they've got a change of use permit to short stay accommodation and they've been classified by the Valuer General as such. Those are the households that will be paying this increase in rates, whereas there are still a cohort that aren't yet classified by the Valuer General as such. I just want to say, as it relates to gaining revenue, we can see the... we'll talk later in the budget motion about it. The impact on the council revenue will not be particularly significant yet because of that, I guess, loophole that I just mentioned where there are some residences that haven't yet been classified by the Valuer General as being SSVAs. But where it does impact the use of accommodation on particularly whole dwellings that are being taken out of the long-term rental market, we've seen from Shelter Tasmania's report that this may indeed have a material impact. I just want to make the point that the state government, as this issue relates to council's finances, it's a prudent move because it will give council more revenue. But I think the state government really needs to do more with respect to ameliorating the housing crisis and with respect to curbing the inappropriate use of short stay accommodation in areas where the residential rental vacancy rate is very, very low, because we know that has a direct impact on renters and rental affordability. So I look forward to the debate, and I think that this is a step in the right direction in line with steps that have been taken by Hobart City Council, by Clarence, and ultimately it is the right move for Kingborough Council. I look forward to the discussion.
Are there any other speakers on the motion? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I have some questions, please, if I may direct them your way through you. So the revenue estimates appear to be on the low side. We're talking about 25 to 50K, thereabouts. Bruny Island is a large part of the share for short-term rentals. So have we sought detail, or is there detail on how the figure was calculated, this $50,000 figure? And do we know what proportion might be coming from Bruny?
Mr. Spinks.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. The reason for the budget figure being low is simply because, as Councillor Cordova has just explained, there aren't many properties at the moment who are classified by the VG as short stay, and so therefore there aren't many that we can apply this differential rate, if it goes through tonight, to. So at the moment there's around about 25 properties, that's all. And our estimate is that, and depending on the valuation of the property, It's going to vary, of course, but our estimate is it's going to be around about an extra $1,000 per property at the 50% loading. So for that reason, it's around about the $25,000 mark. As Councillor Cordova has said, there's a process to be gone through with the Office of the VG to get the remainder of the properties reclassified as SSVA. And as they come on stream, we'll then apply the differential rate to them. And that's why we've provided a range of $25,000 to $50,000 in the budget. Sorry, in relation to Bruni, yes, so of those 25 at the moment, I think 18 are on Bruni. But more broadly, our estimate is around about 80% Bruni-based.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you very much, Acting Mayor. Now, I note that Hobart Council has... the name of Hobart Council has been invoked during the discussion. Their situation is extremely different because they are loaded with commercial hotels. We are not. And these... short-term rental solutions, these Airbnb-type properties, provide a service to our tourism industry, especially on Bruni. And many island residents run their own home or their shack this way. So with the this income helps families, retirees and long-term residents stay on the island. How will this distinction be drawn between... how does the Officer of the Valuer General draw the distinction between what is classified as such versus what is maybe a very short-term income stream for a family for 6 months? Will they be captured in this and then they're stuck with the evaluation for the foreseeable future? How does this work? How do people get captured into this accidentally? Or how do we avoid people getting captured in this accidentally?
Mr. Spinks.
The process is that to be an SSVA property requires a change of use permit, and it's through that process that activates the change of classification through the VG's office. The VG will make an assessment. So in the example of a single dwelling that is wholly put out into the SSVA market, I think that's an easy circumstance. That's an easy assessment to make, so that will be subject to the new rate. In other circumstances where, for example, a single room may be let out, or you may even have examples where on a single property you might have multiple dwellings, one of which might be a principal residence, the other might be SSVA. So taking all the circumstances into the account, the VG's office will make an assessment as to the classification of the property. If he's persuaded that it is predominantly SSVA related, he'll give it a classification, what we call R7, and it's the R7 properties that we will apply the differential rate to.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. That was an albeit technical question that I don't think the average punter out there will probably understand clearly. They'll have to view the recording. Their treatment of different scales of operators. So it's unclear how large commercial operations versus small family-run accommodation will be treated. Now, I'm not aware of any large commercial operations. We don't have any. But can we seek some clarity on the practical implications for each above and beyond? Can you sort of take what you said and make it maybe put it in plain English for the average punt on how they can avoid being captured by the Officer of Valuer General for maybe putting their property on the public market for 6 months, and then all of a sudden during that valuation they're classified and they take it off the market as planned, but they're still they're no longer running it as an Airbnb?
Mr. Spinks.
Look, Mayor, we probably don't have that level of detailed information at the moment. The best answer I can give you is that the Office of the VG makes that classification determination, and as part of our, we're required to use the valuation list as provided by the VG, so whatever classification for a property he determines is what we'll use for rating purposes. In the event that a property is classified as R7, so therefore we'll apply the rate to, but it turns out that the reality is it's not a separate dwelling. It might be just a house with a room let out. the property owner can absolutely appeal to us and or the VG to have the properties reclassified as not R7. So it's not set in stone by any means. The experience with Clarence and Hobart has been they've had a number of these kinds of examples whereby the original assessment has turned out to be incorrect, and so that's just been rectified.
Councillor Antoli.
The revenue generated, will this go to general revenue, or will it be reinvested back to Bruni, for example, where the bulk of the properties live or lie?
Mr. Spinks.
It will go to general revenue.
What do we say to residents who are angry, and we've received already this week some emails, even today a few urgent emails, that this is just a cash grab to fix an ailing budget?
Mr. Spinks.
Look, that can be one interpretation. I think a better interpretation is that the properties that we're speaking of here are commercial in nature, and I think it's reasonable that we bridge the gap between paying the residential rate versus the commercial rate.
Councillor Antoli.
My final question is, commercial in nature, could we sort of specify, because we're talking about mum and dad, owners and investors, renting out a room, renting out a property.
Councillor Antoli, can I just stop you there? Because I think what's continually said here is renting a room, and what's continually being said in response is that that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about whole home accommodation. So if we could remain relevant to what we're actually talking about, that would be appreciated.
No, thanks, Acting Mayor. People are concerned about the thin edge of the wedge. We start with the whole property and then do we move to renting of rooms? But I'll stick to the whole property situation. Given that they are providing a valuable service to the tourism industry in general, and that benefits the community as a whole, their response is, why are we being penalised and classified as a commercial entity? Purely because there is money transacted, given the insurance costs and the admin costs to run this sort of a small little enterprise.
Sorry, Councillor Antoli. The question being...
term commercial use. How do we justify that term, given what the scale actually is, from the mum and dad investor who's one of these sorts of properties?
Understand. Mr. Spinks.
Through you, Acting Mayor. We, the council, don't have to make a determination on what is commercial use. That determination will be made by the Office of the VG.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. I'll hold off any contribution for now.
Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. What evidence or calculation or methodology have we got to justify the 50% increase? Is it connected to a 50% extra loading on council services? And what services are we specifically referring to when we say the increase in burden on the services?
I know we're blurring the line here a bit between this and the budget discussion which comes next, but I'm just conscious that the actual percentage increase is not part of the policy. It's the policy is the mechanism by which we would be able to do an increase of the kind that you've mentioned in the next motion.
Okay.
But I think I've just decided that I don't care and that we'll just answer the question anyway. Mr. Spinks.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. Look, we don't have the sophistication in our data to say the extra cost is X percent. The 50% proposal is put forward on two bases. One is that it's a step between our current residential rate and the commercial rate. And second, this is a proposal the council has looked at in the past and modelled, and that modelling was done at 50% at the time. So all things being equal, that was the proposition we put forward. But it is open to council, if it wishes to go ahead with the proposal, to apply a different loading.
Councillor Richardson.
How and why do these short-stay accommodations being treated as a a commercial property and having an increased rate, how does that differ from any other small business run from a home? And to give you a really specific example that ties back to the potential increased use of council services, I ran a trade-based business from my home for many years. I had vehicles coming and going from that property all day. How can we justify treating a Airbnb or a short stay accommodation differently from any other home-based business?
Mr. Spinks.
Thank you. Well, once again, the answer to that is we have to rely on the property classifications from the Office of the VG. So in the example that you've given, on balance, the VG has obviously determined that the predominant use of that property was residential. In these cases where they're being fully let out, the whole home is being fully let out, it's likely that the assessment will be they are, on balance, commercial.
I suppose the way that I have justified to myself the question that you've just asked, Councillor Richardson, because I think it's a relevant point, is that really the difference between the two is that the income that's being derived by the enterprise is being derived by the use of the property itself rather than a different enterprise that's being operated as a subsidiary use of that dwelling. If that is probably about as clear as mud, but
I understand what you're saying,
Councillor Richardson.
Sorry, I understand what you're saying, but I think then if the argument is increased use of council services, the argument doesn't hold because in both scenarios there is equal and potentially in the other home-based business there is even more pressure on council services. So I think my point in this is it's a pretty poor rationale to place to use the rationale that there's an additional burden on services for this particular type of home-based business and not for others. I'm also troubled by the mechanism, and even more so when we cite examples of the mechanism being applied and then property owners or business owners having to then, for want of a better term, fight to have that redacted. I have a big issue with that. I think there's a potentially perverse outcome of this. We've already said that there's a loophole. We've already said that it's about
the trigger is the general classifying property.
I just think your microphone might have dropped out there, Councillor Richardson. Okay, continue.
That sounds better, or worse. So having that trigger being the valuer general, we have no control over that. It may be right, it may not be right. What that mechanism is and how, you know, to Councillor Antoli's point, if somebody is renting their whole property out for a few weekends a year or 6 months while they're on holiday versus somebody who's actually purchased it and is running it as a commercial business, I think is grey. So I have a number of issues with the policy, to be frank, and because of that, I will be voting against it.
Councillor Fox.
I have concerns about the arbitrariness of the 50% rate increase on top of residential. And I don't understand, and I'd like to know why, we don't charge a commercial rate for a commercial use. It's clear from the document here, items 4.1 to 4.10, that is, the staff feel that this is a commercial use, and therefore have come up with a 50% increase on a residential rate. So why should council be subsidising a commercial use in the community where it's quite obvious that this is a commercial use, not residential, And therefore, I'm hoping to move an amendment in the next item, not this one. But I would like to know why we haven't considered as a recommendation to council that we change the situation and make it a commercial rate.
Mr. Spinks.
Well, as I said a moment ago, Acting Mayor, it was really based on the fact that this is a stepping stone. B, we've looked at the 50% proposal before, but as you flagged, it's open to council to apply any loading it wishes.
Councillor Fox.
That's all I have to say.
Okay.
Thank you.
Councillor Dean.
Just a couple of clarity questions around what's actually before us in this agenda item. We are talking about the rates and charges policy. We're not talking about any specific rates at this point, are we yet?
That's right.
Okay, so this would potentially enable us the capacity to charge a differential SSVA rate. Is that correct?
That's right.
And that rate hasn't been determined yet?
That's also correct.
And if we don't pass this rates and charges policy, we also won't be able to adjust our commercial industrial rates as part of the next item. Because if we don't have that policy set here, we can't do the next bit.
The answer to that question I don't have off the top of my head. Mr. Spinks.
The mere fact that our practice may not reflect the policy does not invalidate the rate. So we've had a commercial industrial rate since 2015 and 2016. But sadly, the policy has been silent in that period. So we'd certainly like to have the policy in alignment with our practice, but it wouldn't invalidate the rate on the next item.
Sorry, Mr. Spinks, does that mean that I'm wrong then and the SSVA rate would still apply if we accepted it as part of the next item?
You would be, if you pass as recommended, by policy, council can elect to have an SSVA rate. On the next item on the agenda, the budget, you would set the differential, if any.
Councillor Day?
Yeah, but if this policy, 15.3 report that we're currently discussing, isn't supported, but then the budget is supported, how does that marry up with the differential rates outlined in that recommendation? Because I take this report here as to have three purposes, is in terms of updating, as you've pointed out, the rates and charges policy, facilitate the residential category, and to account for the varied rates for commercial and industrial use properties. So I'm just worried that if this doesn't happen, this isn't supported, then there's no way that we could possibly support the budget. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Certainly do. I'll just say again, we've had for 10 years now a policy that's not in alignment with our rating practice, and whilst that's unfortunate, it doesn't prevent us from setting a commercial and industrial rate in the next item.
Councillor Dean.
I take this report before us now as not a discussion of whether it's 50% or it's a commercial rate or anything. It enables us to update the rates and charges policy and give us the option of setting a differential rate for SSVA properties. So from that perspective, I will support this recommendation.
Councillor Antoli.
I have more questions, please. Thank you. We've just heard that this policy has not been in line with our rating practice. Can someone explain that? What is it that has been out of line in our rating practice, and what does this policy do to fix that?
Mr. Stewart.
So the rates are set under legislation. There's a legislative head of power that enables council to set rates. The policy is how council will do that and the implementation of it. Now, the fact that we have had a policy that failed to address the industrial rate is not good practice. I fully accept that. It should be all-encompassing of the different rates and the dollar that council applies. However, It does not diminish the head of power that council had to apply those rates fairly to the market. What we're doing now is fixing that, and in addition, as through the workshops that we've discussed with councillors, bringing forward a mechanism under both rates, under both the rates policy, the policy lever, and under legislation through the rates resolution to apply that that rates to short stay accommodation.
Councillor Antoli.
So thank you. I suppose for me the dilemma is that the policy needs updating, but we bolt it on, almost like an omnibill, this short-term rental situation, the SSVA. I believe that the short-term rentals that are in existence in our LGA, whether it be an Airbnb model or not, whether it be a single dwelling or a room, is irrelevant, and I believe it provides a valuable service, an essential service, to our LGA. I'm aware of multiple situations where people have been unable to find a rental because of a insurance situation with their property. It happened to two of my neighbours, and only through Airbnb was that possible. And the insurance company was happy to pay top dollar for them to be in 3 to 4 month accommodation, which they just could not get under a rental agreement. I'm aware, I also value the fact that Bruny Island, the tourism industry in Bruny Island would be dramatically curtailed if it wasn't for short-term rentals. They aren't the most lucrative, people think they are, they aren't really the most lucrative options. When my wife and I ran a rental about 4 years ago, we looked at the numbers and we would make more money by renting it out long term with less fuss, and we did do this, than running it as an Airbnb. So I think it really provides a valuable service to a transient accommodation situation that we lack. We don't have commercial hotels in our LGA, which is sad. We have caravan parks that suits some people but does not suit the majority. I believe this sets us up to wage a bit of a Hobart City Council-styled war on Airbnb, turning them into a pejorative rather than a positive. I think people who invest their capital to provide public accommodation through a short-term rental situation in LGA, in our LGA, provides a service to the people of our LGA, and I don't want to see the thin end of the wedge happen where we have people thinking it will solve a social housing problem. We get more stock onto the market through federal tax incentives for people to do so through negative gearing, and as soon as we fiddle with that, that's when we actually start to fiddle with the market. The more we tax a commodity, the less of it we get, and I think we need more short-term rentals. Unfortunately for me, we've bolted the SSVA to the needed changes to this particular policy. I'd be happy to vote for the policy update, but because they are locked together and bolted together and I don't believe there is appetite to amend it out, I can't at this stage vote in favour of it.
Thank you, Councillor Antoli. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I just have a question to start. I was not at the budget workshop where this was proposed. Sorry, I just dropped my muesli bar, if you're wondering.
Thank you.
Sorry. We bring our own snacks here as well to save costs. I wasn't at the budget workshop where this was discussed, and I thought staff, and because I'd heard that it had been discussed in regards to looking at a differential rate for short stay accommodation, I thought that's when staff sort of have brought this to us, because it was a let's move forward with this sort of idea of bringing it to the budget. I'm just wondering, is that, you know, the reason why it's brought to us tonight? Because it wouldn't have been brought to us if councillors, not that we agree or anything, but, you know, I thought it was raised as an idea if this was something, and so that's why we're having this discussion tonight in regards to this, and the policy therefore is an outcome.
I think you can safely assume that if it didn't have broad-based support during the budget process, Councillor Midgley, it would not have got to this point.
Thank you. Thank you. And so that was quite a while ago, so I guess as councillors, we could have raised any concerns and had, you know, some of the questions that have been asked tonight. We could have asked this of staff to get more information before this tonight. Is that correct?
There have been opportunities for that to take place, yes. Councillor Dean.
Just a follow-up question. We've heard Hobart City and we've heard housing crisis and somehow being tarred with the Hobart City brush. Is this to fix the short SSVA allocation? Is this to somehow tackle a housing crisis, or is this around what the report, as I read it, 4.5 to 12, talk about an adjustment of increased services on our community? Or is this about the housing crisis? I'm not quite sure.
As far as I'm concerned, Councillor Dean, this is not about the housing crisis. This is about accepting that where a property in a residential area is used predominantly for a commercial purpose, then levying a residential rate is not appropriate. This is not a problem that we have had forever on this scale. It is a relatively new problem on this scale. And, I mean, from my perspective, the reason that this is occurring and the reason that I'll be supporting the motion is that there is an equity issue here with a property being used for a predominantly commercial purpose where other commercial operators of accommodation, and there are commercial operators of accommodation that exist in Kingborough, pay a commercial rate. Councillor Dean.
Look, just on that, I guess what has been discussed and what is outlined clearly in the report for me is why I'll be supporting is we have an example where 80% of our short stays are on Bruni. The vast majority of those stays are for short-term, not short-term rentals as we keep hearing, short-term stays which involve an Airbnb provider. When I was growing up in Kingborough, we had lots of people, if you're lucky enough, to own a shack, and you might have gone down there temporarily throughout the year. For the vast majority of the time, it sat vacant. It did not have people coming back and forth, driving the roads, using the facilities, adding to the waste. The reason we now is this put before us, and this is why I'm comfortable, is we have those houses now being let out continuously throughout the year, and an increase in the cost to us as a council to maintain those services. That is the point for me, and we are now going some way towards recovering that cost to be able to actually provide that service and help the residents on Bruni to actually have roads that are kept, that we have bins that are collected, that we have toilets that are clean. Up until now, they are paying the residential rate, and we are not even proposing the commercial rate here. We're proposing a 50% increase. So nowhere near Hobart City at all. So for me, I just can't. The logic being put forward in some of the contributions here defies logic, and for me it is very simple. We are putting forward a sensible solution to help this council get back on a sustainable footing financially, and it has my support.
Councillor Richardson.
Just to Councillor Dean's point, we heard earlier that any additional revenue received will go into consolidated revenue. Is this connected to any additional spend on maintenance of roads, cleaning of toilets on Bruni Island?
No.
Thank you.
But I think the second part to that answer is it's not a particularly popular topic, but the rates obtained from Bruni Island as a whole and even after any increase that's made in line with the next determination would be dwarfed by the spend by this council on Bruni Island.
This will not above what is already provided to Bruni Island?
Not by the function of this motion, Councillor Richardson, no.
Thank you.
Are there any further speakers? Councillor Cordova, to sum up.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. A good discussion. And I think I'm trying to, I guess, condense what we've just heard. Ultimately, the way that I'm hearing this from the room is that essentially this is a choice between do we add a bit of extra burden on people who are running short stay accommodation, or by not doing that, we still have an underlying structural deficit that needs to be addressed, and this council has about $1 billion worth of long-term public assets that we are the custodians of. We have a statutory responsibility to maintain and restore and keep and upgrade and occasionally put in new assets where that is called for. And the question is, you know, if somebody has to wear that pain, I think we're all wearing that pain, whether you're a residential property owner or whether you're a commercial property owner or an industrial property owner, we're all wearing that pain. And then the question becomes, are we sharing that pain fairly, because we're all contributing to these billions of this $1 billion worth of assets that need to be maintained. Over the long term, people who are operating a residential property as a commercial property, for want of a better term, are effectively being subsidised by the rest of the community, and there are indeed not just hotel owners but many other business owners who are paying their full fair share, and then there are the people who are running Airbnb properties who are not paying their fair share. So I think that's ultimately been the discussion, and I think we will strike the right balance by bringing into line, ending this long-term unfair subsidy on short-stay accommodation owners and bringing them closer into line, closer, not fully into line, but closer into line with their counterparts who are operating other commercial businesses in this municipality. So it's a good thing that we're doing. Thank you.
The motion is as printed on page 66 of the agenda. It's moved by Councillor Cordova and seconded by Councillor Bain. All those of that opinion or in favour of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no.
No.
Can I have a show of hands, please? All those in favour. It's Councillors Fox, Cordova, Dean, Bain, Midgley and Street. And those against is Councillor Antoli and Councillor Richardson. Motion is carried. Moving on to page 81 and item 15.4, the operational and capital budgets and rates resolution for 2026-27. Before I ask for a mover and seconder of the motion, I'm going to ask the CEO to provide additional qualified advice in relation to this item.
Thank you. I'll just wait for my screen to connect and possibly disconnect the other screen so we can see them both. Here we go. Okay, thank you. Look, I just thought I'd take the opportunity to walk you through some of the highlights of the budget. Understand that there's a lot to read within the documentation, and so wanted to talk to you all about the process we've been through and what the budget leads us to. So first and foremost, I'll note that the budget is essentially an output of our strategic plan. So the strategic plan is what guides us as an organisation. We went through the strategic planning process last year, and so we have a new strategic plan for the 25 to 2035 period of time. So this is the first budget in the implementation of this new strategic period. We're still guided by the vision of our community as the heart of everything we do, and a purpose of making Kingborough a great place to live. And what you hopefully will see in the detail of the budget papers is a budget that touches all five of the key strategic priorities that shape our spending decisions. I will note that a large input in terms of the creation of this year's budget came from the community consultation that led us through into the creation of that new strategic plan. So that's been used as strong guidance for how we create the work program, but importantly the budget for next year. So how did we get to this point? Well, there's been a substantive program of discussion with councillors around how we're going to respond to the budget for this next year. So seven workshops in all, leading through from February through to May this year, in which point we went through, I guess, the underlying principles of what we wanted to achieve, the financial position of where we were as an organisation, fees and charges. But importantly, I'll
call out one on the 27th of April, where we looked at the first draft budget and did a review of the cost savings that we were proposing across the organisation. And that's, I think, a really key bit of fiscal discipline that we've done this time around, with really looking at what are all the opportunities that we have across the organisation for cost savings and having some hard conversations about that. So that's been a really key informing factor in how we've come up with this year's budget. So a little bit of background on the financial environment we're working in, and apologies if the screen is a little bit small for some people to read, but I'll try and give you some of the highlights. So the Hobart CPI for the March quarter through for the 12 months leading to March was 5.1%. I will note that into April it's just come off that high point just a little bit, and the latest Hobart CPI for April was at 5%. But I guess we're in a relatively high inflationary environment at the moment. As an organisation, we are seeing our depreciation increase, so that's a significant cost driver for us. So 9.3% increase we're seeing year on year for depreciation, so that's an increase of $1.5 million there. And that's driven by revals of roads, footpaths, bridges, indexation of some of those costs, and a few new additions. It's really important that we get the depreciation right, because this is how we ensure that we're a financially sound organisation and have appropriate are appropriate stewards for future generations with the assets that we hold. I will note employee costs as well. It's a significant cost within any local government authority. It typically sits around 40% of most councils' operating budgets. We do have an increase within that space. So 7.4% is the top line figure. But I will note that that's in part driven by the AFL High Performance Centre program, and as we've talked about in the past, those costs are being funded separately by the state government, so it brings the underlying increase for staffing down to 5.3% across the org. One of the pieces that's come into this puzzle late in the process has been around the Tazwater dividend. So as you'll know, councils across Tasmania are the corporate owners of Tazwater. And I can't go into too much detail here because it's still a document that's been provided to us in an embargoed sense. But Tazwater has proposed decreasing their dividend from their draft corporate plan, and so that's something that has been incorporated into this budget at a late stage. So the underlying deficit that you'll hear me speak about and later has got an adjusted dividend figure through from Tazwater, and that's driven off the back of the regulator adjusting their PSP5 pricing structure to a lower level, which has meant that they have then taken the draft decision to adjust their dividend in the short term. We also have local government elections, as I'm sure people around this table are well aware of, this coming up this year, and that is a one-off incremental cost that comes in for this financial year of around $280,000. I will also note the state government waste levy is increasing by 53% this year. Now, that's a straight pass-through cost, so nothing from that is retained by council, but it is an additional cost impost that comes within their overall finances for this year in terms of the take that we require. Council does hold over $1 billion in community assets, which has been touched on in the previous item, and so making sure that we are firstly depreciating those assets is key, but then as we'll talk about more around the capital program, making sure that firstly and importantly we're renewing those assets and being cautious and careful about new and upgrade assets. There are times, of course, we need to upgrade our assets due to conditions and growth, but we need to be cautious about those because it does bear an additional cost burden on council every time we take new assets on in the long term. And as has been touched on in the past as well, council has been operating underlying operating deficits, but I will say that despite that that headline of financial sustainability around the underlying deficit figure there. Council has operated some top line surpluses through that time as well, and so that means that, you know, council's cash position remains adequate to meet all our operating requirements. So it's not a financial crisis we find ourselves in, whilst there is more work to be done to work on the underlying financial model to bring us into true sustainability. And again, apologies for more small print here, but I just wanted to talk briefly about the cost savings that we have undertaken as an organisation. So we have proposed stripping out $1.2 million worth of expenditure from the starting budget, and that was in order to, I guess, bring some of these figures together in terms of revenue and expenditure, and making sure that we are being disciplined in our financial approach to how we adjust our budgets on an annual basis. So I'm not going to go through all of the things in there, and some of the things, the further you go down the list beyond some of the highlights on this list, become rats and mice a little bit. But it, like has been touched on, every dollar does matter. So we are, I guess, looking constantly at where the opportunities are for efficiency. We are looking for the opportunities for effectiveness, and looking to make savings where we can to deliver, I guess, a pathway to sustainability and underlying surplus. So what does it mean for rates? Well, the draft budget as presented tonight has a base increase to the general rate of 6% for most residents. So that, on average, equates to $162 across the year from the average residential property. So that's the increase we're looking at tonight. I will note that we are looking at an increased differential around the commercial and industrial rate, and as has been discussed in the previous agenda item, a differential that increases the short stay accommodation differential 50% above the general rate resolution. So that is proposed, and it's council's decision that they can make tonight around the adopting those general rates. One of the key facets of this budget this year has been a dedicated investment in digital technology. One of the things that we've seen in terms of our processes is that sometimes we can be a bit clunky for the community to work with. So we need to invest in smarter and easier tools for our community to engage with. One of the questions that came through tonight was about SnapSendSolve as a customer-facing platform. And so those are the sorts of technologies we're looking to mobilise to make sure that when people are looking to engage with council and council services, that it's easy, that you're getting updates, that you've got transparency of how the process is going from an internal perspective. So there's work that we need to be doing in that space. On the flip side of that, or the other side of the equation, is around organisational efficiency. So many of the council processes at the moment are currently quite manual, and we know that by investing in more, I guess, evolved digital technology tools, we can create greater levels of efficiency that can both allow our staff to be redeployed into higher value activities, but also to be able to create cost savings through time across the organisation as well. So this digital strategy is a really integral part of the council story at the moment in terms of how we transition from a council of the past to a council of the future and make sure that we're using modern tools and systems in order to bring this organisation forward and make sure that we're delivering the best possible product within the cost envelope that we have available to us. Within the capital program, what we're proposing for the next 12 months is an expenditure of $20.9 million. There's 15.8% of that, which is the capital program for the financial year that we're coming into, and there's a number of carry forwards which bring us up to that total $20.9 million figure, which are essentially projects that are basically underway but due to happen within the first quarter of the new financial year. Part of this is about the process that we've been through in terms of increasing the discipline and prioritisation around how we undertake capital projects. And so we'll look to see increasing levels of capital delivery percentage-wise across financial years from here on out. But really looking to, improve the processes around our capital delivery. On the left-hand side, you'll see some bars which give you a bit of a proportional concept about how much we're spending on the different asset classes. Roads is obviously the hero there in terms of where the council capital budget goes. So the bottom line, as I mentioned earlier, it's not all doom and gloom. Certainly from an overall operating standpoint, the budget will return a surplus, so $2.2 million. However, when you strip away the capital program and non-recurring items, that's where the better indicator of financial sustainability comes, and there we see a forecast underlying result of $2.6 million deficit. Now, that's something that we will continue to work hard on in terms of bringing these figures back into balance in terms of the an underlying surplus, but it is a stepping stone in the right direction. Now, you might note that it is slightly higher than previous years. What I will note is a few of the things that I've already spoken about. We've got one-off costs for things like the local government elections. We've got the increased investment we're making in the future through the digital strategy. And I will note that a significant revenue item in terms of the Tazwater dividend has suddenly changed, and so that's impacted the figures that we've presented tonight. I guess it's an important note to say that an underlying deficit does not mean increased debt. Our debt figures are not forecast to change through the current year. We do have a couple of loans that mature late in the financial year, and depending on Council's cash position, we can make decisions about whether or not we roll them over or whether we choose to retire some of that debt. So this is my final slide. Just wanted to touch on those key points again. So I guess tonight's budget is an output of both the conversations we've been having with councillors over the last few months, but underpinned by that strategy through to 2035. We have done a lot of our homework in terms of making sure that we were taking some of the costs out of the organisation with $1.2 million of savings stripped out of the budget. The recommendation for tonight is around a 6% increase to the general residential rate. We'll be investing $20.9 million worth of capital investment into our communities, making sure that our infrastructure is of the standard that our community expect. We'll be putting a targeted investment into our digital tools and maturity to make sure that we're involving this organisation, being as efficient and effective as we can, and making sure that our customers and community members can receive the services in a modern way. And at the same time, we're grappling with the sort of other headwinds that come, whether it be the decrease in some dividends or whether it be the financial environment around us with the CPI. So thank you for the opportunity, Acting Mayor. I just thought it would be helpful to provide that starting point for tonight's discussion.
Thank you, CEO. Moving to the recommended motion on page 88, do I have a mover and a seconder for the recommended motion? Moved Councillor Bain, seconded Councillor Midgley. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Acting Mayor, and thank you to the CEO for that great summary. I'll try not to double up on too much of the stuff he's already said, but it's quite obvious that this is another challenging budget. Council continues to receive strong feedback from the community seeking enhanced services, improved infrastructure and greater responsiveness. And as the CEO has mentioned, we're also responsible for managing and maintaining a substantial asset portfolio on behalf of our community with replacement value exceeding $1 billion. And I think that anyone who's undertaken any building or construction work over the last few years will understand that these costs continue to rise significantly.
So this budget has a proposed underlying operating deficit of $2.64 million. However, it also delivers an overall operating surplus of $2.26 million. So whilst Council's goal is clearly to reach an underlying operating surplus, the community can be assured that Council is not currently spending more money than it's generating. Just like to touch on three significant items included in this budget that contribute to that operating deficit total, and the CEO's touched on these. They are the digital investment program, the local government elections, and the reduction in the Tazewater dividend. So together, these items account for approximately $2 million. And it's interesting to know that without these investments, one-off costs and revenue cuts, Council's underlying operating deficit would be around $600,000 and moving in the right direction towards that surplus. And given a portion of this $2 million is one-off, and we shouldn't see the same impact on our operating budget in 12 months' time from these items. I'm confident that once we have a solid asset management data in place later this year, Council will be well positioned to finalise its long-term financial plan and establish a clear pathway towards a sustainable operating surplus. The digital investment this year will also deliver efficiencies across the organisation, helping us to achieve that surplus. This year, we've demonstrated our desire to bring down interest payments by reducing our debt by $3 million. We continue to explore opportunities through the future of Kingston Park and other initiatives to further reduce debt levels. And we're also investigating alternate revenue generating opportunities to help reduce this dependence on rates being the major revenue strain. Importantly, I believe this budget also demonstrates Council's commitment to improving our financial position by undertaking this comprehensive and targeted review of operations, identifying efficiencies and savings totaling more than $1.2 million. And I would like to thank the staff across the organisation that have undertaken this work. They've done a really good job. On this topic, I think it's important the community realises that major budget savings, lower rate rises, budget surpluses, etc., can't just happen overnight without significant cuts to expenditure. If you hear the idea of capping rate increases at 2% or having the budget in surplus straight away, I encourage people to ask the question where that $2 million worth of less expenditure every year is coming from. Which community assets may need removing, which services are going to be stripped right back or removed to achieve the savings. To get something, you have to give something. It doesn't just happen with the click of fingers, but as I've said previously, I believe Council is working hard to make sure we're well positioned to finalise the long-term financial plan and work towards an operating surplus. That process may well involve having these conversations with the community regarding what changes they are prepared to live with to keep these costs down. Just to touch briefly on some of the specific items in this budget, whilst the digital transformation is a very large investment, I believe this work is a must-have and not an option or nice-to-have. The benefits that were touched on by the CEO's presentation before, creating efficiencies, improving customer experiences, being able to track your inquiry or application step-by-step through the process, online bookings, better community engagement, improved cyber security. I think it really is where this organisation needs to get to in the digital space. And just finally, regarding the rate increase, I guess I apologise that it is 6% and recognise this may be tough to cover for some of our community. However, I believe it strikes the right balance between being financially responsible, investing in some essential improvements and continuing to deliver the services and maintain the infrastructure our growing community expects and deserves. So with that, Acting Mayor, I'll support the recommendation and look forward to hearing others' contributions.
Thank you, Councillor Bain. Are there any further speakers to the motion? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Thank you, Acting Mayor. And I thank the mover of this motion for explaining that. And I thank the CEO also for that overview. Speaking at a high level here, we bring in nearly $60 million, we spend nearly $47 million, we have the depreciation of somewhere around $18 million, and that's where we're talking about the capital expenditure, but we also have to be cognizant of just keeping the lights on and paying the staff and making sure that all the services that we operate are maintained to an expected level. And basically, there has been past suppression of our rates, and I think one of the failures that we should all, I guess, own up to in a way is, and this isn't just over the last 4 years, it could be over 40 years for all I know, is that I am aware that past councils have kept rate increases absolutely so low at the bare minimum, despite the fact that the cost increases were larger. So if I can use an analogy, let's pretend that you're getting a salary of $100,000 a year, and then you get a pay increase of 3%. So you think, you beauty, I've got $3,000 more to spend. But if your costs are going up at 6% per year, then you're structurally worse off. So even though your cash flow, it's not, as our CEO said, and I'm paraphrasing, we're not in dire straits in terms of cash flow just yet, but we have this structural underlying problem that needs to be addressed. So even though you think you might be getting more revenue in per year, if your expenses are going up at 6%, but your revenue's only going up at 3%, there's a differential there that needs to be addressed. And so we've got $1 billion worth of assets, and we have to maintain them to a certain level. And I think of it like an analogy, like when you're operating a car, if you never get your car serviced, it may well cost you more than had you had regular servicing, because the useful life of that car will be less. Maybe just springing for that oil change every now and again would mean that you don't have to replace the whole engine block because you didn't service it appropriately. So we have $1 billion worth of assets that we're protecting for our community, that we're statutorily obliged to protect and maintain. And if we don't give those regular servicing and upgrades where appropriate, we will lose the useful life that may otherwise have been available to us. And I think in our organisation, when we looked at this underlying structural deficit, and we had a lot of conversations, both around how do we increase revenue to overcome this structural deficit, but also how do we cut costs, there was an expression used around, we want to cut the fat but not cut the muscle. You want to trim the fat but not trim the muscle. And that's the really vexed issue, is because to every individual community member, the must-haves and the nice-to-haves are different. So I'll give some examples. Cutting childcare services at the sports centre, to some people, that means nothing. You know, they don't have kids and they're not using the sports centre, so they don't mind about that. And to other ones, it might be, well, what about fixing those potholes in the road more quickly? Well, maybe, you know, our service delivery has to take a cut there, or moving garbage collection from weekly to fortnightly, or not having as many, you know, not doing road maintenance as regularly, or fixing that roof on your community hall or your sports centre. These are the really hard choices that we have to consider when it comes to cutting costs and cutting services. And as I say, one person's nice to have is another person's must have. And here we are at council trying to strike those balances. So I think where we have all, regularly I see this during council elections, people patting themselves on the back saying we kept rates really, really low. One of the reasons why we're constantly having rate increases that are above CPI is because of all of that legacy issue of not keeping up with the increasing costs of providing the services that council offers. That's my take, that ultimately these are really painful decisions that we have to make, and I have enormous sympathy for all of us. We're all going to have to pay these increased prices, and part of the reason for that is because there wasn't an eye to a long-term vision of financial sustainability. And the reality is we have to reach that point of financial sustainability, and I don't want to get to that point by virtue of cutting essential services to the people who need it most. I want to do it through a methodical and sensible and measured approach in which we all pay our fair share, and those that can afford to pay do, and those who can't afford to pay receive the support and the largesse of those who are more fortunate. That's the position in which we find ourselves. There are real headwinds facing us, whether it's cost of living crisis, the housing affordability crisis, or indeed these more macro issues around fuel and interest rates and the like. This council is trying to deal with those in an appropriate and measured way, but the pain to the community who are experiencing these cost increases is real. And I just want to validate that pain, but also express that if we take a long-term view, we won't have rate increases above CPI, because we will have looked to balance our revenue increases with our expense increases. Thank you.
Are there any further speakers on the motion? Councillor Dean.
I think it's been pretty clear from the report and from the CEO's presentation that in terms of the budget, there's still a long way to go. It's been highlighted that there are significant challenges that have been for a number of years now. And just to elaborate in one area from the CEO, in just this term of council line, so in the 4 years that we've been, or I've been on, our annual depreciation cost has gone from $12.9 million to $18.5 million. So if you add that into the additional wages bill, you're looking at $7.5 million that we need to account for in each and every year. And then on negotiables, we want to pay our staff. Depreciation is something that we need to account for. We can't just whisk that away. In responding to these challenges, I wouldn't support imposing a drastic rate rise, a double-digit rate rise, that could potentially bring us back into surplus overnight. That kind of response would be irresponsible and it would be unfair on our residents, especially in the current cost of living environment. Instead, I'd prefer to see a steady approach to bring us back to surplus. And while a 6% residential rate increase is clearly higher than I'd like, I also understand that there are good reasons for taking this approach. First, as we've heard, our strategic asset management plan hasn't been finalised yet. Without the SAMP, we can't finalise our long-term financial plan, and I know that we're doing significant work in this space to get it done. Until both of these documents are in place, until we have a clear, evidence-based picture of our long-term asset renewal needs, we should not be making drastic rates decisions. I believe a smoother stage response is the more responsible path forward. Second, and as we've heard, this budget does include some important and credible measures. Council has identified over $1.2 million in savings, which is a significant effort for one single year. And while we are making savings, I recognise that we are also actively choosing to invest in our digital strategy, but I think this is a necessary investment. If we want this organisation to move into the 21st century, we must invest in our systems and our processes. Modern systems will make us more efficient, reduce duplication, and ultimately deliver better outcomes for our residents and ratepayers. So just to finish for me, obviously, I'm very happy to support this. When I say very, I probably shouldn't use that word. 6% is not something that we want to be doing every year. And as Councillor Cotter has pointed out, with some more long-term planning, I'd like to see those not over and above CPI moving forward. But it's a necessary budget. It's one that we have to have. And I would like to think that we're better placed to make longer-term decisions moving forward once those key strategic documents are complete. I support the recommendation.
Are there any further speakers on the motion? Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I also like to thank the CEO for the budget presentation. I think we all like a bit of commentary and hearing the voice of our leadership in that space as well. And we can read it all on paper, but presentation is really great. Thank you so much for that. And I guess I always think about our rates and our budget, about how we live in such a fantastic community. And every day we get to see and experience the benefits of what our rates pay for, whether it's our active transport trails, our playgrounds, tennis courts, community events, the grading of our rural roads, sporting facilities, etc. The rates help our municipality, the place we enjoy living in. And I acknowledge that things aren't always perfect and rates do affect household budgets. However, as I just mentioned, rates really are that investment in our community. And I'm sure that every day, when you think about it, if you put that lens, we can see that we can all think of something that has value that's made possible through council investment. I know that staff and councillors, we've carefully scrutinised this budget. Staff have taken it to their teams to look at some cost savings to try and keep the rate increase as low as possible, because we know that every dollar matters and that lens has been applied through all lines of the budget. New systems and procedures have been introduced as shared in the budget work through around managing our capital works programs. Staff have undertaken a detailed review of operational expenditures to ensure spending is focused on essential services and priorities. I'm sure councillors around the table and the community has a really long list of things that they'd love to see included in the budget. But we don't very rarely, put these big dreams and ideas that we might hear from other councils there, because we know that we have a lean budget to work with. Something in the report, I guess I wanted to highlight, that it's important to remember that Council entered the 2025-26 budget process with an underlying deficit of $2.52 million, and the latest forecast has reduced it to $1.23 million. And we know that circumstances can change throughout the financial year and there can be unanticipated savings or additional revenue opportunities. So this gives me confidence that we can continue improving Council's financial position and reduce future pressures on ratepayers. We've also heard from the CEO and other councillors regarding the Capital Works program that covers roads, stormwater, infrastructure, buildings, community facilities, open spaces, parks and other important community assets. And while Council is currently forecasting deficits, it's important to recognise the direction we are heading and, as the CEO said, being a council of the future. We have this challenge in Council. Every day our inboxes are filled with community ideas or complaints or things that they'd like council to spend money on. And we have this real responsibility to maintain essential services, invest in critical infrastructure, look after community assets and plan responsibly for future generations. I feel like this budget strikes a balance between financial responsibility and continue to deliver the services, facilities and infrastructure that our community expects and values. It reflects difficult decisions, careful scrutiny of expenditure and a commitment to improving Council's long-term financial sustainability. So I'd really like to thank staff and my fellow councillors for all the work, especially the staff, that has gone into preparing for this budget. I know it's taken a significant amount of time. I've had to really scrutinise many of the budget areas. And I know that there's challenges ahead, but I will be supporting... Sorry, I know that there are challenges, but I really do believe this budget provides a responsible pathway forward. It continues to invest in our community and positions council to become more financially sustainable in the years ahead. So I will be supporting this budget tonight. But through you, Acting Mayor, I've just got a couple of questions that have been raised to me over the last couple of days, if that's okay. And some of them have been noted to in other councillors as well. Just in regards to the long-term financial plan, I'm wondering what, I guess, is our outline of the work that's currently underway and what is the plan, I guess, for implementation of the long-term financial plan alongside the asset management plan?
Mr. Stewart.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Obviously, a long-term financial plan is an important document as we use it to provide a roadmap for the future financial position of the organisation. As you've rightly mentioned, the strategic asset management plan is a key facet that sits alongside the long-term financial plan. A lot of work is happening on the SAMP at the moment to create what we call a sort of Gen 1 product. So that's basically an outcome that gives us a good view of what our asset future looks like and options that council can choose around how we invest into our assets into the future. But it will be refined and continue to be developed through subsequent periods of time as we improve our asset data and the modelling that sits alongside it. That piece of work is due to be workshopped with Council in beginning of next month, so is getting to a point where we're able to share some of this information back with Council. Once we've got some of that feedback, it'll go onto the mix in terms of generating that Gen 1 product, like I said, that we will look to have adopted in sort of the... Actually, I don't want to put a time on it exactly because I'd need to get advice from the team exactly when that would be, but looking to have a strategic asset management plan that we would be adopting through Council. That allows us to be able to put together the long-term financial plan, which would likely be sort of circa end of this year, start of next calendar year in terms of time frame when we'll be able to put that in place.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you for that. Another question that I had was in regards to the investment in the digital strategy. I've been asked if this needs to be implemented in this budget or could it be spread over 2 years?
Mr. Stewart.
Thanks for the question, and I might defer to my team at some points through some of these questions as well. But look, the digital strategy is a 5-year roadmap for improvements across the organisation. So what we're proposing this year is some of the foundational elements that will then set the basis for further improvements over the lifespan of that plan. So we certainly could spread out some of that investment. What I would say is that will also slow down the improvement side of things, so both in terms of customer experience but also in terms of being able to deliver benefits realisation of some of the efficiency side of things as well. So that is an option. However, I would note there is a flip side to that because the work won't happen and therefore the outputs won't happen in terms of the gains, which is why we're investing it in the first place.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you for that. It's just good to put those responses on record. And the other one, just my final question, was in regards to council loans. It's stated in the report we have the two loans to mature in January and June in 2027. As that interest-free time is approaching, can we have some understanding, I guess, for the community as well, to understand the plans for those, please?
Mr. Spink, sorry.
I'm sure Mr. Smee would love to answer this question. Just to clarify, that our loans at the moment are not interest-free. That the interest-free period expired several years ago. So the budget hasn't assumed any debt retirement at the moment, so it has assumed that we'll roll those loans over. But as CEO mentioned earlier, we'll just do an analysis of our cash position a little bit closer to the event. So one's maturing in January, one in June, and we'll make those assessments then.
Yep. Councillor Midgley.
That's all. Thanks.
Are there any further speakers to the motion? Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm impressed with the eloquence of the speakers so far, both staff and councillors, and I support the budget decision. I'm not going to go into detail, but I do wish to move an amendment, and I'll read the amendment.
Thank you.
That Clause 6, pursuant, that's Clause 6 on page 89, pursuant to Section 107 of the Act, by absolute majority, hereby varies the general rate component as previously made for land within municipal areas, which is used or predominantly used for residential short-stay visitor accommodation, to 0.513355 cents in the dollar of capital value of such rateable land.
Do we have that amendment available? Thank you. Just before I call for a seconder, I'll just ask for it to be put up on the screen, which might take us a few moments. Just while that's occurring, Councillor Fox, correct me if I'm wrong, but the effect of your amendment would be that the properties that are classified as being short-stay accommodation properties would have a rate equal to the general commercial rate.
I was going to say that in my speech.
Sorry, and I've stolen it from you. So the amendment is as drafted on the screen before us. It's moved by Councillor Fox. Is there a seconder? There is a seconder in Councillor Cordova, who can't second the motion because he seconded, who can't second the amendment because he seconded the budget. Did she? My notes may well be wrong.
I think
sorry, we'll just check in.
Councillor Midgley.
We'll just check in with the minutes. Sorry, my apologies. It was indeed seconded by Councillor Midgley. So the amendment is seconded by Councillor Cordova. I'll go to the mover and seconder. Is the amendment acceptable to the mover? It is not. So it doesn't matter whether it's acceptable to the seconder or otherwise. Councillor Fox on the amendment.
0.1513355 is the commercial rate, and 0.334635, which is the current recommendation on the original agenda, is a discount on the commercial rate. And this is an arbitrary discount on the commercial rate. And I'm perplexed why council should be subsidising short-stay visitor accommodation. The results of this subsidy are a loss of rental accommodation and housing availability, cost increase of rental housing due to the reduced availability in the community, a loss of community engagement with permanent residents who live in the community. Should the long-term residents be subsidising commercial use of short-term visitor accommodation by discounting the commercial rates? According to the previous motion, short-term visitor accommodation is obviously commercial and we should be charging commercial rates. Now, anybody who's watching this on their computers at home or their televisions, they can turn to page 64 and 65 and read the discussion section, point 4.4 to 4.12, excluding 4.11. I don't want to read it aloud now because I know I'll exceed the time that I'm afforded to speak here today. But I do encourage councillors to call a spade, not to be making random decisions about short-term visitor accommodation, and to be acknowledging the fact that this is obviously commercial, that the people who are paying these rates are able to discount their tax by the rates that they're paying, whereas normal residents can't. There are lots of good reasons why council should be charging them because of the amount of services that they're increasing use of, and I recommend the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Are there any other speakers on the amendment? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. My read of the room is that this amendment is unlikely to pass, but I'd like to add my weight to why it probably shouldn't. I've mentioned earlier that everything we seem to tax, we get less of. You tax salaries, you get less of it. You tax short-term rentals, you'll probably get less of it. This would pretty much double the rate from the 0.334 to 0.513. So for the average host, my read of it is that the general rate will rise from $2,790 that they'd be paying to $4,280, which is an extra $1,490 a year in a single year. So people would be going from zero to $4,280 in 1 year. And these are not faceless corporations that we're talking about here. We're talking about mums and dads. They're retirees more often than not. They are local homeowners letting out a part of their life to the community to meet a housing need for a important sector of our community. And that's why I said earlier in a previous motion that I believe that they are providing an essential service, and I don't believe they should be taxed on that at all. And this does not take into account, Acting Mayor, the state government's levy that they are putting on short-term rentals. So this is compounding cost upon cost for these people. And what ends up happening is they will just take these homes off the market and they won't be available. It's too jolly hard. So I won't be supporting this at all. I'm gristling with the 0.334 rate, and I wouldn't be supporting a 0.513 increase.
Thank you, Councillor Antoli. Are there any further speakers on the amendment? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. So I support Councillor Fox's amendment, and I thank Councillor Fox for bringing it, predominantly for this reason. If a property is being predominantly used as commercial visitor accommodation, then the fairest outcome is that they are rated in exactly the same way as other commercial properties. It then becomes a question of should this be done all in one go, or should this be grandfathered in, or a step-by-step approach, as the original budget suggests, over several years to avoid the sticker shock to those people, in this case 25 or thereabouts, who are classified by the Valuer General as being short-stay accommodation. There are arguments both for and against doing the slow approach or doing it all in one go. But I think In terms of the fairness argument, that has been well articulated so far, that there are plenty of mum and dad businesses in Kingborough that have to pay full commercial rates because they're running commercial businesses, and anything less than that is a subsidy to those people who don't have to pay that for whatever reason. And the reality is, I would like to be in a situation where we don't have to have differential rates, where rates can be lower for everybody. But the reality is, as we've already articulated, we have this enormous pool of assets that need to be maintained. There are costs associated with them. And the question really, to my mind, is who should be prioritised? Should it be those who can't afford to pay it, or should it be those who can afford to pay it? With respect to the housing issue, you know, we've heard tonight that there are other home-based businesses, and that's fine. We need to think about what the impact of those home-based businesses is. I would posit that home-based businesses that don't directly undermine the housing stock in terms of long-term residential availability are much better for the community than those that do. And Shelter Tasmania's research found that in Greater Hobart, where there's a very high proportion of short-term rentals, 47% of those Airbnb short-term rental properties in Hobart City had a long-term rental history. That is to say, they were taken off the long-term rental market. And that even the withdrawal of 195 of those properties from Greater Hobart would move the residential rental vacancy rate from 2% to 1%, where rent rises are likely to exceed 10% per year. So there is an impact of having a whole bunch of short-stay accommodation, whole homes, both on Bruni and on mainland Tasmania. The council papers do accept this principle that short-stay visitor accommodation is effectively commercial use. So it's happening, and that's already placing additional demands on garbage collection and on road use, and also on noise and impact on neighbours as well. So we have to think about what are the consequences to our society in general of placing a whole bunch of hotels in areas where people didn't think when they moved in there they'd be next to a hotel, because they were zoned residential and they didn't think that there would be commercial operators there. But where there are commercial operators there, they should be paying exactly what the other commercial operators are paying in order for us to have a fair system. And as I say, I don't want any commercial operators to have to pay lots and lots of money. I think that's unfortunate. But the costs of running a council mean that we do have to have a system where people pay their fair share. Ultimately, I prioritise renters over short-stay accommodation owners. And I want to make very clear that I do genuinely sympathise with people who are going to feel this cost impost. And there's no shirking that. This is a cost impost. But what we're saying is, when it comes to running a $1 billion asset portfolio, somebody needs to pay for it. And we think that short-stay accommodation owners have had a pretty good run so far by being subsidised by the other commercial ratepayers and by the rest of the Kingborough community. I think this is a fair rating measure, and it's a modest housing step. I think the reality is that this is certainly not going to be the silver bullet to the housing crisis in Kingborough. The reality is that the state government needs to do much more than they've done, and they've been asleep at the wheel. But that's why you see Hobart City Council asking the TPC for more powers with respect to governing and curbing short-stay accommodation, is because the state government is asleep at the wheel on this issue, and they've damaged the housing options for Tasmanians. But that's why you see councils like Clarence and Hobart and now Kingborough trying to do what we can around the edges to make the situation more fair and reduce the burdens that are being caused by people who are suffering awful rental stress, and also the burdens of commercial operators who are paying full price while other people get away with a long-term damaging and unfair subsidy. So for all those reasons, I think that this is a good move. I think it's a fair move, and I applaud Councillor Fox for bringing it to this council tonight. I'll be in firm support of it. Thank you.
Are there any further speakers? Councillor Richardson.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I detest this amendment for all of the reasons that I expressed earlier, and I think it is extraordinary that we've gone from an argument an hour ago that a 50% increase on the residential rate was a fair, reasonable and equitable way to apply this rate, to then further increasing it again. So my fear is that there are some that just do not like short-stay accommodation, and any nail is hit with a hammer, and any, no, that's the wrong analogy. Any angle, I wind it back. Any angle that that these people can come at to make short stay accommodation more burdensome and more difficult is a fair and reasonable tool. So for those reasons, I will be voting against it.
Thank you, Councillor Richardson. Councillor Payne.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. Just briefly speaking, because I'm going to go against the amendment. And the reason I won't be supporting the amendment is I don't believe we can say that all house visitor accommodation is being used as full-time commercial purposes. I believe we still have residents in Kimber who regularly utilise their shacks in summer holidays, school holidays, etc. And then maybe they offer it up for short stay to help supplement their costs when they're not utilising it. So for that reason, I believe commercial rates are unreasonable, and I'm happy to stick with a 50% increase just to reflect that these properties are generating some income and additional foot traffic, which can then go back to the rate base and support the costs associated with that. So I'll be voting against the amendment.
Thank you, Councillor Bain. Councillor Cordova with a question.
The question, thank you, Acting Mayor. The question is about predominant use. My understanding was that the Valuer General will set the Valuer General will determine if a property is predominantly used for short stay, in which case the issue that Councillor Bain was raising about sometimes people are there and sometimes they're not there, isn't it true that if people were spending 6 months at their own house and then occasionally Airbnb-ing it, isn't it true that the Valuer General wouldn't categorise them as short stay anyway? So isn't that true that the Valuer General determines if somebody's short stay or not based on predominant use?
Yes.
So is it also true then that what the issue that Councillor Bain was raising about sometimes people are there and sometimes they're not there, that's actually not relevant to this conversation, because this conversation is about those that are categorised as short stay predominant use?
No, because I think it would be entirely possible for the Valuer General to assess a property as predominantly being used for a commercial purpose for short stay accommodation, but the residents still having significant usage of that property for personal use.
Would they not
then just... If it was 60-40, say, Councillor Cordova, then that would still be a very, very large proportion of personal use.
But couldn't they then take that to the Valuer General and say, I've been incorrectly measured as R7, incorrectly categorised as R7?
Well, Mr Spinks will correct me if I'm wrong, but in the circumstances that I've just described where it might be 60-40, that would still be predominant commercial use. Mr Spinks is nodding his head, but perhaps he might... like to correct me if...
Yeah, look Mayor, Acting Mayor. I think this is how the VG determines these kinds of classifications. Probably something we have to understand a little bit better. And so that's what we'll certainly do before we start applying it.
Are there any further speakers on the motion? Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I have thought about this since Councillor Fox emailed us her intent of putting this forward, and I do support many of the matters that Councillor Cordova has shared, but I do, and I know that as councillors when papers come before us that we can look at different motions and amendments and things like that to make changes, but I do feel like it's a bit of policy change on the fly. It's unfortunate that we've got a budget, you know, that we're looking at that is the main section of this report, and that we could have had this discussion, say, a couple of weeks ago, thinking about that. Also, and I just want to clarify, my understanding, Clarence and Hobart do have a rate differentiation for short-stay accommodation. Is that correct, and do they apply the commercial rate?
Mr Spinks, what do we know about Clarence and Hobart?
Thank you, Acting Mayor. Yes, it's correct in both cases. They have a differential rate for short stay. In both cases, they apply double the residential rate, but it is, in fact, slightly different from their respective commercial rates.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. And do we have any understanding in regards to why they haven't used the commercial rate?
Mr Spinks.
No, not really.
I think you'd have to ask them, Councillor Mitchell.
I might, yes. So, I guess we are making a significant change. I do know that we need to look at in our short stay, absolutely taking away whole homes as rental. We are, as we have spoken about tonight, we have, and we've shared many times at council, we are in a a housing crisis. We need to ensure that we have as many homes available for people to either purchase to live in or to rent. But I just feel like this right now, I think we go with what is actually in the report versus making this next step, but I'm not opposed to looking at this in the future. Sorry, Councillor Fox, in regards to that, but, yeah, I won't be supporting the amendment.
Councillor Dean.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. Just out of respect for Councillor Fox for putting this amendment forward, I will just make the brief contribution that I won't be supporting, and as we've heard other people outline a number of the reasons why. For me, it's very comfortable with what was originally proposed on the basis that we've heard a lot about Hobart and Clarence, but ultimately we are not Hobart and Clarence. They do not have an island with 80% of their Airbnbs on them. And so we can't really compare. I think it's still unclear whether going down full commercial rate, we can't be sure of the unintended consequences, but I feel comfortable that a 50% increase on a standard residential rate that is currently being used for under the SSVA classification. So as we've heard, a predominant use, so they're generating significant income. I think that is something that they can weather. So I'm supportive of it. And as I've said previously, that comes around from the intensification of use and in greater burden on councils' expenses to maintain that intensification use on Bruni. So I will be not supporting this amendment.
Thank you, Councillor Dean. For my own contribution, I won't be supporting the amendment. I'm of the view that the 50% increase is a modest additional contribution to the rate base from those properties that are assessed as being predominantly used for a commercial purpose. Insofar as it impacts Bruni Island, that means a proportional increase as those rates are levied to infrastructure on the island. What I mean by that is that income comes into general revenue and does get distributed across the entire municipality, and that will include Bruni Island. And that's why I'm largely supportive of it. There needs to be some acceptance that these whole properties wouldn't be going on the short stay market if there wasn't revenue attached to them. And they are being used where they're assessed as such for a predominantly commercial purpose, and I think that a 50% increase is a modest contribution to the impact that has on community infrastructure and the rate base. So I'll support the substantive but vote against Councillor Fox's amendment. Councillor Fox, to sum up.
I appreciate the comments around the table and I don't take offence. I'm not dying in the ditch over this one, but I do want to read out 4.9 and 4.10 from page 65. Under the equity and fairness principles, properties generating commercial profits should face commercial scale overheads. Imposing a different rate ensures short stay visitor accommodation pay their fair share for the local infrastructure that has been effectively commercialised. Further, under the equity principle, it can be argued that if not paying a commercial scale overhead such as council rates, that they then enjoy a competitive advantage over other styles of commercial accommodation providers, e.g. hotels, motels and caravan parks. I added the caravan parks. I don't really think I have much more to say other than the fact that I didn't raise this earlier in a workshop because it was reading the agenda tonight, or that we're looking at tonight, that triggered this whole concept to me, and the discussion part really clarified to me that we're making a mistake. We should be charging commercial fare. Thank you.
The motion to amend was moved by Councillor Fox and seconded by Councillor Cordover. It is as printed on the screen. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no.
No.
Show of hands is required. All those in favour, please raise your hand. Councillor Fox and Councillor Cordova. Those against, Councillor Rantoli, Councillor Dean, Councillor Bain, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Richardson and Councillor Street. We return to debate, or the motion to amend is therefore lost, and we return to debate on the substantive motion. Are there any further speakers on the substantive motion? Councillor Rantoli.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. I'd like to add a note that the Tax Office does not deem a renting out of your home as a commercial enterprise, which is interesting given that we think it is, and I can quote that later. Acting Mayor, I won't be voting for this budget tonight. I expect it will pass, and I respect that numbers may carry it, but I will not put my name to it, and I owe my peers and the community my reasons. Once again, Acting Mayor, we face an underlying deficit this time of around $2.6 million, and by my count, it is the 19th deficit this council has delivered to the Kingborough community in 22 years. And each has been delivered while rates kept climbing. And I don't believe this is not misfortune, it is to the ratepayers, this is not misfortune, it is a pattern that has been chosen in this chamber year after year. Acting Mayor, about a week ago I was in a rural community in Victoria doing some work for a council there, some sensitive work that I won through public tender, and I was having a meal with the Mayor and some of his key councillors, and I mentioned that this particular council had delivered 22 consecutive budget surpluses. And I asked, how have you been able to pull that off? And the answer was extraordinary. He said, our council does not accept a budget handed to us by the bureaucracy that is in deficit. And they require the leadership team to present only a budget surplus. They have 21,000 people, 11,000 ratepayers, and an LGA that is 8.5 times bigger than Kingborough. They have a budget of $70 million, 199 staff. So very comparable to us in terms of the scope. And when they asked me how many surpluses we had provided over the similar period of time, I said it was three. And it was humiliating. And they were gobsmacked. They went into silence. I would like to give credit where it is due. This year, the Chief Executive and his leadership team found real savings, more than $1.2 million. And without that work, this deficit would have been well over $1 million deeper. So the lesson is plain to me that when leadership resolves to act, it can. But now we must finish what has begun, and we can't go into delivering deficits. We simply cannot. At our budget workshop, I was told that certain things were off the table, and I don't believe those things should be off the table. And I won't go into what those things were, but we have an obligation to present to our community a healthy budget, and I can't see how any of us would survive on the board of any organisation in the commercial world delivering 19 P&L deficits in 22 years. I think we would get away with it once. I think after about two times at that, the shareholders or the leadership structure would eject us from the leadership and the governance of that commercial enterprise. As I understand it, there's only two councillors in this room who have ever run a business. I'm one of them, and I know for a fact that the only deficit I ever delivered as a CEO got me into so much hot water with the board that the only way I could deliver it was the sale of a multi-million dollar property to get away with it. And that board made it clear to me that if that happened again, my job would be on the line. I don't believe that opposing this budget is the same as opposing progress. I strongly support our investment in modern digital systems and our AI initiatives, which are groundbreaking, particularly in planning. I think done well, these will lift our service and in time reduce our staff costs, but what I cannot accept is funding them through a record deficit and yet another 6% rise. I would like to note that over the past 22 years, we've only increased rates around 2.8% twice. It hasn't been this history of 2.8%. It's typically been 4.5% to 5% since about 22 years ago. I think it's immoral to go to the community and ask them to continue to subsidise our failure. The Auditor General's own analysis has found that more than half of Tasmania's councils are spending beyond their means. Well, we've done it for two decades, and in plain terms, we're asking our community to pay more so that we may lose more. This doesn't mean that good work isn't happening, and this doesn't mean that I don't support the work that we do. Could I ask for three more minutes, please? I'll probably only need about 50 seconds.
Moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Bain. All those in favour, please say aye. To the contrary, no. Show of hands is required. Please sorry, it's getting late. All those in favour, please raise your hand. Councillors Antoli, Cordova, Dean, Bain, Midgley, Richardson and Street. And those against, Councillor Fox. The motion's carried. Please continue, Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Acting Mayor. Thank you, Piers, for the extra time. For me, colleagues, this for me is the line in the sand. I believe that the next council composition after the October election should move a motion mandating that budget surpluses and the discipline choices to deliver them must be handed to us from next year. I believe that we should probably have an independent review of the way we are managing our budget. And I understand that what I've shared may trouble some people around this table, but I'm far less concerned by what is unpopular in this chamber than by how unpopular this budget is with the community we serve. Since it was announced, I have received 60 messages against the budget, just to me personally. It's the community's judgment that I value far above the grumbling of anyone in this room. No disrespect intended by saying that. I believe this is the inheritance of poor decisions over more than two decades. I don't point the finger at any individual. It's been going on for 22 years, and someone must finally draw the line. So tonight I'm drawing that, as symbolic as it may mean, and for this reason I cannot and will not support this budget. Thank you.
Are there any further speakers on the motion? There being no further speakers on the motion, I'm going to make a contribution. I support this budget. I do so because it's responsible, it is disciplined, and because it reflects the financial reality that council faces. I think it's important to note that this is not a budget that has materialised from thin air. Councillors have been involved in a long and detailed process over several months to get to the point where this budget has been presented. We have had workshops on strategic asset management, council's financial position, the draft capital program, fees and charges, cost-saving opportunities, the operating budget, and the capital works budget. Every councillor's had an opportunity to ask questions, test assumptions, and raise concerns and influence the outcome of this budget. I say that because I want to be clear. It would be one thing to vote against a budget because of a principled objection that's been held throughout the process. In my view, it's quite another thing to participate in the process, understand our financial position as it is, understand the consequences of the difficult decisions that we have to make, and then decide at the end that opposition is all of a sudden required. I don't think that's responsible, and I don't think that's financial discipline. Proposes a 6% rate increase, which is too high. But what's your rate increase? It is as close to CPI as we can responsibly make that rate increase, in my view, with Hobart CPI to March sitting at 5.1%. At the same time, and incredibly importantly, Council have identified budget savings of more than $1.2 million. Those savings are real. They've been identified, outlined by the CEO, and they are real. And the report tells us that every 1% reduction in rates is going to cost council $440,000. So the question is, to anybody who says just lower the rates or this should be a surplus budget, what are they going to defer? What are they going to cut? Or how much longer are they prepared for council to be in deficit? The budget makes fairer revenue choices. We've done short stay accommodation to death, and I've made my view on that very clear, so I'm not going to rehash it. As the CEO has pointed out, we invest approximately $1.35 million in digital transformation, and that's not because technology is fashionable, but because better systems mean better customer service. It's a worthwhile investment in efficiencies going forward that are going to save council money and are going to improve services for ratepayers, which is what we are about. And I think that that's what residents expect from us. I've supported budgets over the last 7 years which have tried to suppress rates as low as possible, and I stand by those. And I believe that this is another such budget. We've invested in services, or maintained services, invested in infrastructure and responded to growth while trying to keep our overall rate low, and we do rate in the middle of the pack and at the lower end of metro councils, and that's something that I continue to be proud of and will wear on my sleeve wholeheartedly. But this budget is a shift. It's a sharper and more disciplined budget. I think that it accepts that council must improve its long-term financial sustainability, and it is the start of addressing the structural problems that face us. So I support the budget. I encourage councillors to do the responsible thing and support it as well. Are there any further speakers on the motion? No. Councillor Bain, you're the mover. Do you wish to sum up?
Yes, thanks. Thank you, Acting Mayor. So just firstly to thank all the councillors' contributions and also to thank all the staff that put a lot of time and energy into putting this budget together. I think you've heard around the table that nobody around this table is happy about a 6% increase. I hope the community can see that a lot of work has gone into identifying savings, explaining the reasons for any new investments and outlining why the rate increase is required. The community can be assured that council is not currently spending more money than it's generating, and we will be undertaking work on our long-term financial plan over the next few months to work towards an ongoing surplus. Council's worked hard on this budget, identified saving opportunities. I haven't heard any more saving opportunities raised tonight, so I encourage my colleagues to support this budget.
Thank you, Councillor Bain. The motion is as printed on page 88. It's moved by Councillor Bain and seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those of that opinion say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no.
No.
A show of hands is required. All those in favour, please raise your hand. Councillors Fox, Cordova, Dean, Bain, Midgley, Richardson and Street in favour. And those against, Councillor Rantoli, the motion is carried. Does anybody need another break? No. Excellent. Moving on to page 157, item 15.5, nomination of licensed persons, and the recommended motion on page 159. Do I have a mover for that motion? Councillor Midgley moves and seconded Councillor Bain. Councillor Midgley.
Just waiting on the mic. I say move. I have nothing else to add to this. It makes sense and I support the motion.
Are there any further speakers on the motion? I can only assume, Councillor Midgley, that you have nothing further to say on the matter, and so I will put the motion as printed on page 159. That's moved by Councillor Midgley and seconded by Councillor Bain. All those in favour, please say aye. Contrary, no. That motion is carried unanimously. Moving to page 159, notices of motion. At the time the agenda was compiled, there were no notices of motion received. Moving to page 159, confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session. If I'd known this was coming so quickly, I wouldn't have asked whether anybody wanted a break. I'm sorry. Can I have a mover, please, that in accordance with the Local Government Meeting Procedures Regulations 2025, Council by absolute majority move into closed session to consider the following items: confirmation of minutes, applications for leave of absence, tender assessment AB2604, Kingston Beach Foreshore Revitalisation Stage 2, Dens Point Hall Gallery lease, and a contractual matter. Moved by Councillor Fox, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour, please say aye. To the contrary, no. That motion is carried unanimously. In accordance with the Council Meetings and Councillor Workshops Audio Recording Guidelines Policy, recording of the open session of the meeting will now cease. Thank you all for watching tonight's very important meeting, and for those who have joined us in the public gallery, sincerely appreciate your presence. The open session of Council adjourns at 9:06 p.m.